Welcome to the Exotic Pet Collective. My name is Richard. Thank you so much for joining me today. We've got a couple of very exciting, very special guests, and we'll be talking about venom and the effects on the human body. But first, I do need to give a shout out to the sponsor of today's podcast, and that is TarantulaCribs.com. If you're looking for high-end, very clear, strong, secure enclosures for your tarantulas, scorpions, or pretty much any invert or reptile, as long as it's like a small reptile, you should definitely check out TarantulaCribs.com. I actually just moved my Arizona desert centipede into one of their enclosures. They sent me one of the largest enclosures. I was going to put a T. blondie in there, but I got to wait a little bit for that substrate to come in. So I figured my centipede needs a new enclosure. Let's try it out. And it's been a few days and it has not been able to escape. It's really seemed to settle in. So I can vouch for them working for some species of centipedes. So if you want to get yourself some really cool enclosures, go check out their website, TarantulaCribs.com, and use the promo code TCollective10 at checkout to receive 10% off your entire order. Now, our first guest today graduated from St. Louis University with a bachelor's in biology and went on to obtain his medical degree at Kentucky College. He then went back to St. Louis University to finish up his medical training, and he has a special focus in wilderness medicine and has given lectures at St. Louis University regarding arthropod bites. Most recently, he is working as an ER physician and hospital medicine physician for the past 3.5 years. You may know him as the owner of Tarantula Cribs, but today he is here to talk about the medical aspects of bites and stings. So please welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Dalal. It's good to see you, buddy. How have things been?
Pretty good. You know, staying busy, as you can imagine, both with work at the hospital and Tarantula Cribs. So it's been good.
Yeah, very cool. All right, so our second guest is a man that actually needs no introduction. I'm sure you're all well aware of him, but I'm going to do it anyways. He is a wildlife educator that has traveled the world seeking out venomous animals in their native habitats. He is the host of the YouTube channel Brave Wilderness with over 18 million subscribers and probably over 1 billion views at this point. He is an author. He's won an Emmy for his series Breaking Trails, as well as being the host of Animal Planet's series Coyote Peterson, Brave the Wild. Please welcome to the podcast, the Knight of Bites and the King of Stings, Coyote Peterson.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on the show. Happy to be here today.
Thank you so much for joining. I'm very excited. This is I've been looking forward to this podcast for a while. One of the questions I get the most on my YouTube channel is people asking about bites and stings and, you know, what it feels like to be envenomated. You know, we talk a lot about tarantulas and scorpions and other types of inverts and exotic pets. I feel kind of like we're on two separate spectrums of this. You know, I was watching some of your videos last night with my kid. We're both huge fans, and he was kind of giving me a hard time because he really enjoys your content. He's not a big fan of my content, you're going out into nature, you're finding these spiders, snakes, and scorpions and, you know, kind of finding them in their native habitat and interacting with them and getting bit and stung in some situations, where I actually do the opposite. I stay in my basement hidden here in the foothills of the Appalachians with, my spiders, snakes, and scorpions safely in these enclosures. And I make videos about, you know, kind of teaching people how to take care of them to avoid getting bit or stung. So I don't have any experience or knowledge about venom. So I'm really excited to get both of you guys on the podcast here to talk about this.
Yeah, well, I certainly, you know, I love your backdrop there. It seems like you are probably in the arachnophobic nightmare experience for anybody that's afraid of spiders with all the cool looking creatures you must have there in the background. So yeah, I'm happy to share any of my experiences that I've had today and any stories that you guys feel are pertinent. Certainly been through some pretty crazy, I should say, I've put myself into some pretty crazy scenarios to experience some of these bites and stings, but there's obviously a rhyme and reason behind what it is that we do and why we do it. So you guys let me know whatever you want to know, and I'll do my best.
All right. Thank you very much. So Dr. Dahl, you've been on the podcast before. It's awesome having you back. So do you want to kind of kick things off with just how you got involved?
Involved in bites,
you wilderness mean, medicine and
yeah. So I mean, as you know, I've always kind of had a passion for wild wilderness, nature, that kind of thing. And so taking one passion with the other, medicine and nature, and putting it together kind of gives you wilderness medicine. And it's a really cool niche. It's something I can't always do, obviously, can't always be out there. But when we do get to do it, it's really fun. And so You know, with regards to spider bites, as you know, most of the time it's not a spider bite. So we see lots of patients always coming in and always complaining of, hey, I got bitten by a spider. They've already made up their mind that it's a spider, but most of the time spiders are not apt to bite. And so kind of kicking that off, I did want to, I know that, Coyote, you have not, have you been bitten by a spider? I haven't seen you bit. Yeah, you know, if I handled a black widow, you did not get bit.
Yeah, no, there, you know, a lot of people have been like, Coyote, will you intentionally get bitten by a tarantula, or you can get bitten by a black widow? I mean, getting intentionally bitten by a black widow is not a whole lot to see. So no, I've not been bitten by a black widow. I've never done a bite from a tarantula because, as you guys know, tarantulas are not very prone to biting. To really make a tarantula angry enough to bite you, you got to kind of push it in a direction that we just would never really be comfortable with. So while I've been bitten by spiders off camera, just inadvertently, I've never taken an intentional spider bite at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was something I was discussing last night. My son was asking why you had never been bit by a tarantula. And I was like, he would probably have to go far out of his way to get a tarantula to bite him. They're more prone to run and hide. You really got to upset one to get him to strike.
Yeah, it's kind of like, for at least in my experiences, and again, this is just basically with the tarantulas in the Southwest and a couple of species in Central America. In most instances, you're right. They're more apt to moving away from you, maybe flicking off some urticating hairs, or at the very least, they're really just going to kind of sit there and crawl on you. And to really ever kind of push that animal to the point where it feels it needs to bite, we've never been comfortable being like, okay, cool, we're going to just keep pushing on you until you bite somebody. It's not going to happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, have you ever been haired by a tarantula?
I have actually before. Not really bad. Like, nothing's ever gotten into my eyes, but I have gotten like a couple of flecks of something into my nose before. And that's just, you know how easily those hairs can flick off. So
right. It's
all about, anytime I interact with them, being as calm as possible and really letting that spider acclimate to you and let it walk up onto your hand, versus, like, you know, you don't just come in and pick it up and place it there. You got to gently coax it so that it doesn't feel threatened.
Correct. Yeah. And actually, medically, I'd be more concerned about the hairs. I mean, if those hairs get in your eyes, they can barb in there. They get into your cornea. You sometimes need surgery. Sometimes the eye surgeons will go in there and actually pick them out. And then you need months long of antibiotics and steroids, and it's a disaster. I'd be much more afraid of the hairs getting in my eyes than a bite.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. We, you know, we always tell people in any episodes that we interact with tarantulas to, you know, it's not something you need to be afraid of. Don't try to pick it up and handle it. Admire it from a safe distance. And really, we tell people to not interact with them, not because worried about somebody being bitten and envenomated, but more so because of those urticating hairs. So That's a really good point.
Yeah, I've been keeping tarantulas and scorpions and stuff for over 20 years at this point, and have never been bitten or stung. And, you know, I found a little, I was, you know, I think it was the episode where you went to the reptile sanctuary in Sydney, Australia, and there was a gentleman there milking the Sydney funnel web spiders, and had said he had never been bitten. And I was like, yes, finally, there. You know, you can interact with snakes and scorpions, and maybe not so much snakes, but tarantulas and scorpions, and avoid getting bitten, especially if, you know, if you're taking the correct steps and you're being safe. I did have a question for you though. I get asked this a lot. There's some species of tarantulas like Postletharia metallica, you know, a lot of like the Asian arboreal tarantulas that have very potent venom. And, you know, there hasn't been a whole lot of scientific study on the effects on the body. But you do have a lot of people, you know, when they're reporting the effects of the bite, they say that they're dealing with kind of like the side effects of the venom weeks or months down the road. You know, like they're dealing with like muscle spasms and stiff joints and issues like that. And I was just wondering, Coyote, with all the venom injections that you've had from different species, have you been dealing with any kind of health issues further on down the road?
Yeah, that's a great question. I get that asked me quite often. And, you know, the one thing I always say to people is there's a big difference between a bite and a sting when it comes to the venom, the compounds in the venom, and of course the venom yield, because venom yield is a big aspect to play with things. And as you guys know, or for anybody that's watching, when an insect stings you, that's a defense maneuver for the most part, right? Not necessarily the amount of venom where something's trying to kill and eat something else. So I'm getting stung by something like an execution wasp or a bullet ant. You know, that's not the amount of venom that an animal will be looking to kill its potential prey item versus something like the bite of a rattlesnake. Now, I've never been bitten by a rattlesnake intentionally or accidentally, thankfully. The most potent intentional bite that I've taken with venom would be the giant desert centipede. Now that one was extremely painful and I had some pretty severe after effects in the days after the fact, but nothing long-term. Same goes for the Gila monster. I was accidentally bitten by a Gila monster, which is without question the worst pain I've ever experienced. But again, the after effects were nothing beyond a 36-hour level of discomfort. There were no lasting effects from that envenomation. But it's also fair to say that it was a very minimal amount of envenomation. My thumb was in the mouth of that Gila monster for less than a second before I ripped it out. So it's not like it got a hold of me and chewed in a large venom yield. So I think there's probably something that has to do with the amount of venom that somebody takes as to whether or not it's going to have a long-term effect.
Right. And you did get stung multiple times by those bees on your face that one time. And I did see you got an allergic reaction that time.
Mm-hmm. When we did the bee beard that went wrong, I was stung close to 60 times between my face, my neck, my chest, my arms, and my hands. So that one was a pretty noticeable reaction, the way that my face had swollen up. But a lot of the swelling went down within the course of about 3 to 4 hours. The next day, my face was puffy and swollen. And within 48 hours, I was pretty much back to normal.
Did you have any trouble breathing or anything like that?
No, it's certainly something that we were concerned with, considering the number of stings I had taken and how fast that venom took reaction and swelled me up. Fortunately, though, no, I didn't have any problems breathing. And within a couple of minutes, you kind of know if anaphylactic shock is going to kick in. So we kept a really close eye on me. Obviously, I have epinephrine pens on location every time we film an episode like that. So once we realized, like, okay, this is just now looks ridiculous and we can continue on with the episode, it became pretty lighthearted. But man, the amount of pain that it took to have that many stings, and again, unintentional stings with the bee beard, it was one of the most painful experiences I've had, especially around your face and your eyes and your ears, very sensitive areas to be getting stung.
So there was an episode where you were comparing the stings between the Arizona bark scorpion and the giant desert hairy scorpion, I believe.
It was actually a striped-tailed scorpion and the giant desert hairy scorpion. Haven't been stung by the bark scorpion based off of so many people's warnings who have been stung by it and the after effects that come from that species.
I got you. I apologize. So I actually have like all three of those, here in my collection. And, you know, we talk about them a lot on the channel. And, you know, you had discussed in that episode, the relation of between like the size of the pedipalps and the actual, strength of the venom. And I was just wondering if I could, if both of you all could elaborate a little bit on that.
Sure. I'll let you go first, Doc.
Yeah. I mean, as far as I know, the general rule of thumb is that the larger the pedipalps, the less venomous the sting would be. Now, you know, most doctors, most physicians aren't going to know the difference between all the scorpions. So that's just the general rule of thumb. I don't know that that is a hard set rule. I don't know if, Coyote, you have more experience with that, but just generally, that's what we would go by.
Yeah, that's kind of my general rule of thumb as well. And, you know, certainly with the intentional stings that I took from the striped-tailed and the giant desert hairy, you know, the striped-tailed is one of those ones where they do have small pedipalps. But the thing is, they're also a very small scorpion. And in doing research and talking to entomologists in the Southwest, you know, they said, look, the striped tail is really not that bad. It might be, believe it or not, a little worse, depending on your venom yield, than the giant desert hairy, but it's nothing on par with like a bark scorpion. Now, the other scorpions I've interacted with internationally, whether that's in Central America, I've seen scorpions in Australia. If I see one with small pedipalps, I mean, my immediate reaction is like, I have no idea how potent this venom can be. And scorpions are tough. I mean, you look in basic field guides, they usually only have like a couple of generalized scorpions. And it's so difficult to properly identify species that are in rainforest locations or in areas where you're like, is this a totally newly described species? A lot of times it's really difficult to know exactly what it is you're working with unless it's within the United States. So I am always extra careful when I'm dealing with arachnid species in other countries, because you just never know how potent that venom is going to be. And, you know, we don't go out of our way, or I should say, I don't go out of my way to ever be intentionally stung by something that I've not done an incredible amount of research on.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Titimus species of scorpions. They're found, you know, in Brazil and South America, and they're small. They've got little pinchers. They're beautiful scorpions, but they pack one serious punch with their venom. So, I mean, a lot of people are very, very cautious around them. And it always kind of struck me, you know, I've got these big, impressive scorpions, you know, like the Asian forest scorpion and emperor scorpion. And, you know, they're massive, but, you know, their venom's, the effects of the venom is a lot, you know, similar to like a bee sting. Like it really doesn't cause much pain at all. It's the little ones you got to be careful with.
Right.
Now, if someone were to get stung or bit, what is the first thing they should do as far as like treating that?
Doc, I'll let you go first. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, it depends on what you're dealing with. Obviously, if it's some aphe on a palma, it's probably not going to do too much. But you should definitely cleanse the area with some soap and water, and then you can just put pressure on it, and it should be okay. Most of the time, the immediate reaction is not very painful. There's going to be some mechanical damage, just the size of the fangs might damage some structures, might cause some bleeding, but you're not going to have anything too severe, and you should be okay after that. Now, if it's a post-litharia or an HMAC or something like that, it's going to be different. Initially, you may not have pain at all. Some of the venom actually has some paralyzing effect and numbing effect, so the initial pain might not be there, and then you'll go into more severe muscle cramps and things like that. At that point is when you may want to seek medical care. There are things that they can do at the hospital, like fluids. You may need a tetanus shot. And later down the line, if there's an infection, you'd want to get antibiotics and that type of thing. But the initial care, I think, is just general first aid. Wash it off with soap and water, keep the area nice and compressed. And that's the best thing to do initially, and then contact the healthcare professional. And by the way, if you get bit, seek care from a doctor that you know. Don't take medical advice here, obviously.
that's a really good point. And the one thing I was going to add to everything you said is pretty much spot on. And in our line of work specifically, when we're producing videos and you've got the number of eyeballs on a video, and we always say to our audience or whoever it is that's watching, watch the signs of your body. Consider certain bites or stings potentially medical emergencies, right? If you're bitten by a venomous snake, a copperhead, a water moccasin, a rattlesnake, you know, within the realms of the U.S., let alone one of the species outside of the U.S., it's a medical emergency. When it comes to spiders and scorpions, you know, again, it depends where you are, and pay attention to the signs of your body. If you feel like your throat is tightening up, if you feel like you're having some sort of an allergic reaction, go seek medical help as quickly as possible. But if you take a bite from a spider and, you know, it's a wolf spider or a tarantula or something that you don't necessarily recognize, pay attention to the bite and, you know, let your body be the one that tells you whether or not you truly need to seek medical help. But when in doubt, there's nothing wrong with going to the doctor to at least let a medical professional know what it is that you've been through.
Now, yeah. Coyote, as someone that's been bit and stung by, you know, a various amount of insects, you know, like spiders and scorpions, could you, I know that different types of scorpions and spiders have different types of venom, like the chemical makeup of it is drastically different. So it would have different effects on the human body. And I was just wondering if you could maybe elaborate a little bit, or maybe describe the different types of pain that you've experienced from being envenomated.
Sure. Well, I mean, that could be a really long-winded answer. I'll try to keep it as generalized as possible. Again, there's a big difference between bites and stings when it comes to venom yield. So venom yield is first and foremost the most important factor when it comes to likely the amount of pain that you're going to experience. So I think everybody's pretty familiar with the fact that I've been stung by a bullet ant. Now, I was stung by a single bullet ant versus ever wearing the bullet ant gloves or, you know, shoving my hand into a nest of bullet ants. There's a rhyme and reason as to why we produced that episode the way that we did. And the bullet ant specifically is armed with a Panera toxin that specifically has almost a time release pain agent to it. And the purpose of that is more for the protection of an ant's nest. Now, the makeup of an ant society is structured in a variety of ways, and the ants that guard the front of the entrance to their den, right? And most of the times, they build a nest that is compartmentalized into a very large tree. So you might only find a little tiny hole in the ground. Those ants, those soldiers that are guarding the front of the nest are usually more aggressive and usually have a more potent venom. Now, I don't know what the reason is for the potency of that venom, if it's what it is that they're eating, if they've been designed a specific way to combine what they're eating together with their venom and their aggression level to be more painful. I just know that we were instructed in the research that we did ahead of time, if you want the truly painful sting from a bullet ant, you got to catch a soldier. The random ones that are foraging around out in the rainforest don't necessarily have as potent of a sting. Now, the Panera toxin that comes from the bullet ant, like I said, almost has like a time release agent to its pain. And it's extreme right from the get-go, but it lasts and lasts and lasts. And my experience lasted close to 36 hours. But some of the indigenous tribes in Central and South America that will wear the bullet ant gloves that are taking dozens of stings at a time, they can spend days going through an incredible amount of pain and ultimately end up going into a state of hallucination, which is part of that spiritual ritual that they go through that transitions them into essentially qualifying as a hunter for the tribe. Now, if you look at something like a tarantula hawk, very large wasp, it's going to have a larger venom yield, but it's a very fast-acting venom because, as you guys, of course, know, the tarantula hawk uses its sting to paralyze a tarantula so that it can then drag it down into a burrow and essentially start the life cycle again by implanting an egg or several eggs. I'm not sure which it is. But that sting is so incredibly hitting from the get-go because that tarantula hawk needs to immediately paralyze that tarantula. So there's going to be a big difference between the potency of a tarantula hawk sting versus something like a honeybee. But then again, if you look at honeybees or you look at basic, hornets or paper wasps, you disturb a nest of something like that where you're taking multiple stings all at the same time, that compounded effect can sometimes be worse than maybe the single sting of a tarantula hawk. So I'll kind of pause it there and see where you want me to go. But there is quite a bit of a difference based on the species of insect that is delivering the sting, the venom yield, and of course, what that venom is used for specifically.
I understand. Yeah, I always found it interesting when people would be describing in a bite report, especially from different species of tarantulas, just the wide variety of how long the pain lasted, if there was swelling, if there was numbness, it always kind of struck me as interesting that even just different species in the same genus can have different effects on the body as far as their venom is. But I am curious, doctor, if someone were to be bit or stung, like I know here in West Virginia, there's like the hospitals have no anti-venom, especially for like a lot of the scorpions and spiders that I have. So if I were to get bit and needed to go to the hospital, first off, what would I need to tell them for them to be able to treat me? But also what would they have at their disposal as far as treatment?
Right. And so if a patient's coming into the hospital and their chief complaint is got bit by a spider, first of all, what we need to do is verify that it was actually a spider bite. So in order to verify it was a spider bite, we have to do a few things. We have to, the patient has to have seen the spider, captured it, seen it bite you, and then have symptoms compatible with the spider bite. If they don't have all of those, it's not a verified spider bite. So 99% of the time it's not, and we need to look for other medical diagnosis. In the case that it is a confirmed spider bite, a lot of it is just symptomatic treatment. So is there any damage to the area from the fangs? Is there, obviously, if you're going into anaphylaxis, then we need to address that. But really, otherwise, it's symptomatic. So pain medications, muscle relaxers, fluids, that kind of thing, checking routine lab work, and then kind of going from there. So there's actually not a whole lot. Obviously, in the case of anaphylaxis, that's a completely different picture and a completely different story. Then we need to utilize life-saving measures to improve breathing and keep circulation up. But in the case of a regular spider bite, there is no anti-venom here. I know in Australia they have it for the funnel web, but not here. We don't use any anti-venom for recluse or widow bites.
So really, it's just pain management and checking for anaphylactic response.
Correct. Yes, exactly. That's pretty much it. And yeah. So checking for other things, that's the other big thing.
So what would be some of the most worrisome symptoms that you would start getting if you had been envenomated?
Yeah, the number one thing is always watching out for anaphylaxis. So anaphylactic symptoms would be lip swelling, tongue swelling, difficulty breathing, wheezing, feeling like you're breathing out of a straw, that kind of thing, and maybe passing out. And those are all very dangerous for sure. And it obviously call the ambulance, call the ER, get there as soon as possible. But other than that, you know, it's just symptomatic fluids, pain control.
That's a good answer. You know, I've always been a little concerned, you know, having all these different types of venomous creatures here in my basement. Well, not so much I'm concerned. I think my kids' parents are concerned. You know, they're a little hesitant to let kids come over and play. And, you know, I try and assure them that, one, everybody is safe and secure in their enclosures, but two, they don't go out of their way to try and bite you. You know, a tarantula's not looking to hurt you. Scorpions are running and hiding any chance they get, whether they're in captivity or in the wild. You know, you gotta be doing something kind of, you know, I don't want to say like a kid would have to open up the enclosure and really be messing with some of these, to get a chance, that they would get struck. What I'm curious about is there any kind of like, data on how many people are envenomated to the extent that they would require some kind of hospitalization? I mean, is it something that happens more frequently than maybe we think of, or does it just not happen very much at all?
At least in the United States, it's not very much at all. I don't know if that there's any raw data, but I know that there's, you know, thousands and thousands of reported bites. And out of that, you know, maybe a few, I've actually never seen anyone hospitalized for a spider bite. I have for a snake bite, but not a spider bite.
Now, coyote, so I don't know. Has there, in your history, making YouTube videos and you've got the show on Animal Planet, have you had any close calls where you needed hospitalization or at least your crew was considering taking you to the hospital?
Not throughout the making of the television show. And again, you know, good production always puts you in the safest scenarios possible. The amount of research that you do, taking your time, trying to be as careful as possible whenever interacting with any animal species. And again, we're constantly working with experts in the field, whether you see them on camera or not. We take every protocol that we possibly can to ensure the safety of myself, the animals, and of course, the crew. The only time that I've ever had to seek medical attention was actually after the giant desert centipede bite. And that was on my own accord after 9 hours of excruciating pain to the point, when we say excruciating, it's like you think that it might be better to cut off your arm because it might be less painful to be missing an appendage than it is to continue dealing with the pain of the venom. And I essentially went to an emergency center, sort of made up a clever story for what happened to me, so it didn't seem like I intentionally got myself bitten by a centipede. And, you know, they basically prescribed me like a super strength Advil, so to speak, just basic painkillers to say, look, this is going to take the edge off. The swelling will probably go down within, you know, the next 24 to 48 hours and you'll be fine. And, you know, people don't know a whole lot about centipede bites because there aren't that many people getting bitten by giant desert centipedes. So my education in the subject matter ultimately ended up being a pretty cool, like, long-term test that I could probably write down or share with somebody that wanted to do a journal entry someday. But the biggest discomfort actually came in the following 2 weeks with the amount of itching that came from the bite. I ended up having this almost like a couple of BB-sized lumps in my arm, kind of where the fangs or the pinchers went into my arm. And I don't know if that was like the destruction of cells underneath the skin, but I would have several times throughout the day where my arm would just like flare up with this uncontrollable itch and it would swell back up. And then after I stopped messing with it, you know, in about 45 minutes later, it would swell back down. And this happened consistently day on and day off for about 2 weeks after the centipede bite. So, you know, I don't know what exactly caused that from a medical stance, but it certainly was a discomfort to deal with. But I'd rather be itching than be hurting.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. And you're exactly right. We don't have a lot of experience with centipedes. And so I was just reviewing my emergency medicine textbook and there's not even really a section on it. So, you know, we don't have experience. So maybe one day someone will reach out to you for a case report.
So is the fact that there's not a whole lot of medical information on these because they just haven't been studied? Like, I know a lot of species of tarantula are just being discovered, you know, right now, you know, being described. So maybe there's not a whole lot of information out on those species, but species that have been around for, you know, decades, at least, you know, scientifically described, when you look for medical information on them, it's usually very lacking. Is that just because there hasn't been funded research into those species, or is it just because there hasn't been any kind of interaction with humans where they're getting bit?
Yeah, so I think it's two parts to it. One part is that there's not a lot of funding. There's not a lot of money to be made, honestly, with creating medications for these bites. There's not a lot of bites happening. And even if they do happen, most of the time, they're not life-threatening at all. And so pharmaceutical companies aren't after them to really study them. And then the second whole issue is that when we do study, we're actually studying the venom for therapeutic reasons and not necessarily trying to discover any treatments or cures, just because the symptoms aren't that bad. And so there are actually a lot of really cool studies out there studying the components of the venom. I know we were kind of talking about the venom load, the amount of venom, and then the different components. And so there's actually one study that shows that one of the reasons the post-Letharia venom may be more toxic is it contains an enzyme called hyaluronidase, and that kind of breaks down your connective tissue, the tissue around your cells, and that allows the more potent parts of the venom to go deeper and in, and that can cause a longer lasting reaction. And then the venom load is a lot more with those species. So that would explain why the venom is so much. But again, the research doesn't have to do with therapeutics. It has more to do with trying to find out why the venoms are toxic the way they are, and maybe trying to find some therapeutics for pain or something like that.
Yeah, I remember reading an article about some medical research that was going on. I believe it was the Deathstalker scorpion's venom. It had some medicinal properties, and they were saying that it's worth 10 times its weight in gold or something like that. You know, they're like millions of dollars for a gallon of that venom. But, you know, Coyote, I was watching this one of your videos where you had got stung by the tarantula hawk wasp, and you were describing the pain in the arm. You were pretty much saying your arm was paralyzed. Now, when you were feeling that that kind of paralytic kind of coursing through your body, was it accompanied with pain, or was it completely numb in that area?
Oh no, it was extreme pain. I mean, and, you know, it's funny to look back at the tarantula hawk sting. It was one of my earlier big wasp stings, or big potent stings, when we started the insect sting pain index sort of climb. And I mean, the best way I could liken it is just, I mean, it's like a lightning bolt of pain. And almost if you've ever been shocked or had, like a TENS unit that you use on your muscles where it like kind of like seizes things up, that's kind of the experience that was happening in my forearm and essentially like contracting up into my hand and fingers that like almost put my arm in a state of paralysis. And, you know, the effects of the venom having that on me, you know, look, I mean, I would assimilate that to the same thing that happens with a tarantula. Obviously, the tarantula hawk's venom is enough to put a tarantula in a state of paralysis for weeks, if not months. So the small effect that it has on a human is noticeable within, you know, a 5 to 10 minute window. After that, I wasn't experiencing that sort of muscle contraction, but it's the pain that's kind of, that comes along with it. Of course, you've got a heightened sense of adrenaline and fear and anxiety that's all happening at the same time because you don't know what your body's going through mentally as you're experiencing this pain and this sort of paralysis. So I think it's a combination of everything together that makes that experience so traumatic. While I certainly put myself into that situation, I can only imagine what it would be like if you were a kid playing along the edge of your swimming pool and a tarantula hawk comes down to get a drink and you inadvertently find yourself getting stung. I mean, it's just something that it's the cause of nightmares for the most part. So, but again, the tarantula hawk is something that has no interest in ever interacting with a human, which is, you know, kind of to your point, Doc, that there's not really any anti-venoms for these things out there, because while it may have a big stinger, it may be incredibly painful, it's not going to kill you. You're going to go through the experience, and at the end of the day, you're probably going to be completely fine. There's, I think, zero cases of people having any sort of truly long-term negative reaction from the sting of a tarantula hawk, let alone the fact that I'd argue to say there's probably less than 10 people a year that get stung by a tarantula hawk. So there's no reason for people to really be afraid of them.
Now, do you have any tips on how to kind of get through that type of pain? Like anything that you got, like, you know, like, what am I trying to say? Like mindfulness kind of, you know, like kind of watching your breath, or, I mean, is there anything mentally that you can do to kind of ease the pain a little bit, or you know, at least kind of help you get through that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, it's certainly easier said than done, certainly for anybody that were to be stung by something and not be able to control their mental state. I mean, one thing that I often say to people is, as I went on with taking stings, like the tarantula hawk, I was far less prepared for the pain and how my body would react as compared to something like the Japanese giant hornet. Now, the Japanese giant hornet was far more painful than the tarantula hawk, almost where, like, I'd rather take a couple tarantula hawk stings than another single giant hornet sting again. But my mind and my body were capable of balancing that pain a little bit better. So it does have to do with breathing technique. It does have to do with putting your mind in a place where it's like, okay, you're going through this massive amount of discomfort, but as long as anaphylaxis is not setting in, you're going to get through this. Just embrace the pain. You almost have to put yourself in a state of meditation to get through it. And eventually it does dissipate. But with something like the giant desert centipede, for example, no meditating in the world is going to alleviate the pain that you're going through, which is why I eventually went to seek medical attention after 9 hours of excruciating pain. Like, you know, you're in a soup can, it hurts, but it eventually starts to die down. It's a lot different with venoms. And in some instances, those venoms will keep delivering their punch. But with a tarantula hawk, it comes and it goes rather quickly.
Yeah, that's something that I've, you know, I noticed myself. I mean, not so much from a bite or a sting, but anytime I've been through pain, just kind of, you know, using some breathing techniques, being mindful of the pain and kind of aware of it, you really kind of like get to know or experience that, you know, it's not just a single pain, you know, it's not one event, you know, it's coming in waves and it'll kind of dissipate and then come back. So, I mean, I always wondered, you know, when you were envenomated, if there was any kind of, you know, like mental tricks that you were using to kind of get through that, because I can only imagine how painful that would be.
Yeah, a lot of it honestly kind of turns into a blur, especially when we're in the midst of filming an episode. That's always the hardest part, is to go through the sting, then recompose myself and be like, okay, now you've got to explain to the audience what it is that you're feeling and going through while still composing fluid sentences to the best of your ability and having it make sense. I don't swear in any of the episodes, which I know a lot of people call out. And it's certainly very easy to drop curse words when you're in that sort of pain. But then again, it doesn't necessarily make it family or brand friendly. So, you know, there's a method to the madness and a certain stylistic approach that we've taken to all of it. But putting yourself in the right mental spot is definitely a big piece of it.
Now, with everything that you've kind of been through, at least the videos that I, you know, I've watched over the years, probably the most stressful one was the episode with the bullet ants, where you were actually trying to capture those. You know, did you get any kind of training beforehand? You know, like did the locals kind of help you decide, like figure out exactly how to spot their, you know, their hills, their, you know, or how exactly did all that go down? Did you just go out there and try to find them, or did you have like local guides or anybody kind of helping you out?
That's a good question. So bullet ants are kind of a right place, right time sort of thing. You can't just wander off into the rainforest and ever look for anything and be like, yep, you're going to find it. You have to have an idea of where a specific species might be. So we did work with local guides who had spots that they knew they had seen bullet ant nests in the past. But these aren't people that are going out looking for bullet ants so that they can film an episode on somebody getting stung. So we were given directives as to the types of trees to look for, where they had been seen in the past. We actually, what you didn't see on cameras, the first spot that we checked, we actually struck out. The nest that had been there previously was abandoned. And for what reason, we don't know. I mean, people don't know a ton about bullet ants or why their society moves from one spot to another. But we did eventually find a pretty large functioning nest. And when we were instructed on how to catch it, we were told to look for the hole in the ground, more primarily because you don't want to accidentally walk up to the tree and be standing on the entry, the ground entry point to the mound, because those ants are going to come up your legs and then you're going to be in all sorts of trouble. So we very carefully investigated where the entry point was. We knew that those were going to be the most potent ants. And then the process, they're like, just stick a stick in there. The ants are going to attack a stick and grab onto it. They bite on with their mandibles. They start trying to sting. And they're like, you won't have any problem catching them once you find one. But certainly from the filmmaking aspect, helping to build up that intensity, getting an ant safely away from the nest and out into an area where we could safely encapsulate it and set up that sting. You know, for doing it for the first time, I mean, what you see in the episode is exactly how it went down, and it's a little chaotic, and it was definitely riddled with anxiety, but we were honestly more excited than anything that we had found ants and that we were going to be able to pull off the episode.
Yeah. One of my favorite things is seeing how excited you get at capturing it, you know, whether it's a wasp or an ant, and then immediately that kind of change in mindset, like, well, I caught it. Now I get it stung.
Well, you know, and the thing is, you know, people that are not looking for certain things always end up stumbling upon them inadvertently because they have no interest in wasps or lizards or snakes. So you always hear these amazing stories. Yeah, I saw, you know, 20-foot boa constrictor. And I'm like, if I could find a 20-foot boa constrictor, it would be the greatest thing ever. But, you know, it's always the people that aren't looking for the animals, because you'd be surprised how hard it is to find some of these species. It's not like you just walk into a backyard and, oh, there's magically a bullet ant nest. You know, where we were to film those ants specifically, we were pretty deep into the rainforest, but even the reserve that we were on is pretty far separated from typical society. So, you know, it's never easy to find these things, but that doesn't mean that people won't inadvertently run into them. And our big thing that we tell people at the end of the day is just, leave it alone. Like, none of these animals have any interest in interacting with you, and they're not going to bite or sting you if you just back up. You know, if you're going to go after something, be like, oh man, a tarantula hawk, I'm going to try to swat it and kill it. Well, of course the thing's going to defend itself and you might end up getting stung in the long run. So if you just leave it alone, you're going to be totally fine.
Yeah. That reminds me of the episode you did in Costa Rica where the fertile ants was right behind you and you were right on top of it, but it did not, you know, it didn't touch you. You got, I don't know. I guess
that was a lucky one. That is when people say, what are some of your closest calls? You know, it's not necessarily the moments with bears or tiger sharks. That is honestly one of the closest calls I've ever had, because what people don't realize is that if you're bitten by fertile ants on your hand or your foot, it is going to be bad. There's a good chance you're going to lose that appendage just because of how necrotic that venom is. But if you're bitten, like crouching down, and you're bit on your thigh, or if I had gotten tagged near like a vital organ, like my kidney, like where that snake was lined up and how far they could strike, if it had lunged out and bit me near my kidney, likely would have been impossible to save my life at that point, because it's just the kind of spot that you don't think of being bitten. You know, if venom gets close to a major organ or a collection of organs, especially something like your kidneys, oh man, it is bad news. And even a small, that wasn't even a big fertile ants. That one was like maybe 2.5 feet long, but it doesn't matter if it's a fertile ants this big or one that's 4 feet long. That venom is incredibly potent.
Is there any correlation between the amount of venom, you know, a snake or pretty much anything that's venomous will inject? I guess what I'm trying to say, like if it's a baby, if it's a small one, am I correct in assuming that it has the same amount of venom as a full adult? Or does it sometimes, I mean, how does that all kind of work out?
Well, Doc, do you want to answer a side of that? I have an answer. I don't know if you have one too.
In terms of tarantulas and all that, I have read that a bigger Pokea postlitharia will be an increased venom load compared to a spiderling. And so spiderling's venom won't last nearly as long as an adult. In terms of snakes, I know sometimes snakes can deliver dry bites and all that, but I don't, you know, I'm not a herpetologist. I don't know in terms of if it depends on the size and all that. Maybe coyote does.
Yeah, sure. So when it comes to insects and arachnids, the one thing that I always say to people as well is, you know, the venom gland has a buildup of venom, right? So if you've gotten stung by something, it's not necessarily capable of stinging you again and again and again with the same amount of venom. Like once that venom sac drains out, it needs time before it can produce more venom. Same thing goes for snakes. And the misnomer that a baby snake has a less potent venom than an adult is not true. Like, for example, let's use the fertilance. A baby fertilance has just as potent a bite as an adult. But yes, there is a difference in venom yield because a larger snake just physically is going to have larger venom glands. So a 4-foot fertilance has the ability to inject a massive amount of venom as compared to a baby one. But the components can be very similar and can be equally as toxic. Now, when you've got a large snake, it's obviously eating bigger prey. So a bigger venom yield, a more toxic venom is going to be needed to take down a larger prey item. A baby fertilance is eating small geckos, little frogs, maybe little invertebrates, but a large one's going to be eating, you know, jungle rodents or even possibly birds if they can manage to get a strike on one. So venom yield does vary based on the size of an animal, or I should say based on its the point in where its life, where it's at, baby versus adult, juvenile in between. But the venom yield or the toxicity to the venom rather is equally as potent and equally as dangerous. We actually were just in Costa Rica and we filmed with a baby fertilance. I've never seen one before. It was this big and we treated it just as equal as the 3.5-foot fertilance that we had filmed with a couple of days previous. So if it's a venomous snake, you got to treat it with respect.
Now you mentioned in one of your shows that when you were a child, you got bit by a giant water bug.
Yes.
Okay. I'll make sure I had the species correct. And then you reenacted that in one of your videos, where you had one bite you on the toe. Now, mm-hmm. How did that pain compare? Cause I'm sure it was a different species. I believe that one was in Costa Rica, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So was it a more painful bite or was it essentially pretty much the same?
So giant water bug, great one to bring up because that is technically a bite, not a sting. A lot of people are like, oh, it's a water bug. It's a bug. A bug must sting and must not bite. The giant water bug has a rostrum that's almost like, you know, those machines that they use to put down cattle, the bolt things that they'll put in the center of the head. It's like, boom, just shoots a thing in. That's what the rostrum of the giant water bug does. So it's like having a hole punched in you. And it's a very potent, very effective venom. I mean, the giant water bug can kill very large prey items, baby turtles, baby snakes, frogs. So it's pretty crazy for a bug to be able to eat something like that. But it's the components of its venom that are so potent in the way that it essentially breaks down the insides of its victim so that the water bug can then almost drink it up like a disgusting slushy. When I was bitten as a kid, I didn't know anything about giant water bugs. And as I'm wading through swamps trying to catch turtles, to be bitten by something like that, obviously at a young age, experiencing an excruciating pain like that, you have no idea what's going on. So it's much more traumatic. But remembering that, or however it played out in my mind as a kid, and then recreating it as an adult, and of course, their nickname being toe biters, we were like, well, we got to get you bitten on your big toe. It was definitely a nerve-wracking scenario to go through. And I would say I was more nervous to be bitten by the giant water bug than I was many of the stings that I took, just because I know that rostrum has a larger gauge than a stinger, and it's going to put a different kind of venom in me as compared to a bullet ant or a tarantula hawk.
Yeah, that one looked quite painful. And it made me wonder, you know, how did this all begin? Like, where did you get the idea or the desire to film yourself reacting to different bites and stings?
You know, it's so funny how that came about and how that has become so wildly successful, which certainly I'm grateful that the audience seems to love watching me rolling around on the ground in agonizing pain. And they're hopefully learning something at the end of the day. But any good wildlife presenter, don't care who you are, whether you've made it in this industry or you haven't, all of the best people are good at not being bitten and stung by things. Because if you're constantly getting chomped inadvertently, you're obviously not really good at interacting with animals. So the fact that we found this fascination for the audience where the intentional stuff was getting a lot of intention or a lot of attention was just a really interesting conundrum. And we were like, well, I guess we could play into this. And if it's a way to draw on the audience and educate them about things that they were likely very afraid of, and to show to them the effort that I have to go through just to get close to these things, let alone catch them and sort of induce a sting, maybe will help lessen people's fears about them. At the very least, they're going to get some wild entertainment out of it. But if they can absorb some of the education, we felt it was a great way to put the spotlight on some creatures that really people glaze over. I mean, can you really look back at the past wildlife presenters like Steve Irwin, Jeff Corwin, Jack Hanna, Marty Stauffer? Have any of them ever stopped to really look at the bugs that exist in the world, let alone the fact that, you know, we've got a video out there, or I mean, many videos with all these bugs. I'm using the bullet ant specifically, and to say that bullet ant video has over 50 million views. Did anybody ever imagine a bullet ant would be that much of a celebrity in today's entertainment space? Probably not, but it's pretty cool to have told the story of that species specifically and all the stinging or biting creatures that I've interacted with, because it puts a spotlight on something a little different than your typical lions and tigers and rhinos and bears and so on.
Yeah. I mean, I am personally very fascinated with the invert world. I enjoy videos about, you know, snakes and alligators and the large stuff. But it's the inverts and the arthropods that are fascinating to me, because they're so alien and they're so unlike a lot of the other species on our planet. You know, there was this one video, that you were talking about, I believe it was the Sydney funnel web one. They were discussing different ways of milking they're milking the fangs of the Sydney funnel web spider. It was kind of hard in the video to see exactly how much venom was pulled off of that. But I mean, were you just talking about, you know, just a few drops of venom that came from that experience, or was there a little bit more that you just couldn't really see?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've done this twice. I did this for YouTube, and I also did it for the Animal Planet series. It's important to note that there's a difference between the male and the female's venom. The female venom, while it does have a bit of value, they don't actually make the anti-venom from the females. It's only the male's venom. And the males are far more aggressive than the females. But when it comes to spider aggression, the Sydney funnel web is arguably, at least in my experience and what anybody in Australia will tell you, the most aggressive spider species in the world. And it is without question the most dangerous. I know we've had people write back to us be like, Sydney funnel web isn't the most dangerous spider in the world. Look, I've worked with the experts in Australia that work with the Sydney funnel web spider, and they say without question, it is the most dangerous spider species in the world. But when it came to the milking, you don't see a lot of the venom, small little droplets. And the way that they suck it up into the pipette, there's an airflow that's happening that's actually helping the pipette suck the venom in. And it's once that venom dries and is crystallized that they then are able to get it out using some sort of a reagent. This all happens after the fact. We didn't show any of this on camera, but it is very, very tiny drops of venom, which is why they have to milk so many spiders on a yearly basis. And what's cool about the Australian Reptile Park is they're actually breeding Sydney funnel web spiders there. There's a whole lot that's going on behind the scenes that you don't necessarily see in the episodes, where they have these giant shipping containers that are reorganized to be these shelves. Richard, you'd absolutely love it. All of these shelves of Sydney funnel web spiders that Kane Christensen, who I worked with to make those episodes, he's milking these things daily. And they've got an entire, like, incredibly well thought out process for how they move through the spiders and then cycle back. And it's a process to essentially create enough anti-venom every year to save the, you know, handful of people that are bitten. And more people are bitten by Sydney funnel web spiders than probably any other spider species, specifically because the Sydney funnel web spiders are in areas of human habitation. And they do come into houses and they are aggressive. Like, you could walk past the Sydney funnel web spider, it will jump out and try to bite you. Why? I don't know. But I have witnessed the aggression of this species, and it's pretty intimidating.
And everything seems to be a little more intimidating in Australia. You know, I get a lot of comments and messages from people wanting me to make videos on this Sydney funnel web spider, asking if I have one in my collection. And it's like, no, I have no interest in bringing that into my house. They seem pretty intimidating, you know, but
yeah.
I got into tarantulas and scorpions, because I was afraid of them. You know, I was 18 years old, freshman in college, and, you know, just scared to death of spiders, and kind of got talked into, getting a pet tarantula as a way of kind of overcoming my fear. You know, the more I learned about it, the less afraid I became. I was wondering if you're in your experience, getting bit by these or stung, by these creatures out in the wild. Does that kind of help you overcome any fear or anxiety, you know, if you were to come across them again in the future? Or does it kind of heighten it?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, it's fair to say that I don't have fears of any of these animals. It's why I'm so comfortable interacting with them. I'm honestly more afraid of environmental challenges sometimes than I am the animals themselves. And by environmental challenges, I mean sudden shifts in weather, possibly falling off of cliffs, you know, those sorts of occupational hazards. But when it comes to the animals themselves, I think one of our biggest goals is to always create scenarios where we're really encouraging the audience to take a deeper look at certain species. And while you may be afraid of it, you know, just the therapy of watching it on camera through the safety of your phone or computer or television screen can really help you overcome things. We actually have an episode coming out next month that we just filmed in Costa Rica. It's a new sort of experiment that we're working with. You know, you never know how you're going to be able to create a hit viral video. But we came up with this concept of really working within the realm of phobias specifically and putting me into a scenario where what would your worst case phobia be? And in this particular instance, we went first with arachnophobia, and we created something that we call the spider helmet, which is this clear plastic container that went over my head, rests on top of my shoulders, and inside we add 20 giant golden orb weaver spiders. Now, as you guys know, the giant golden orb weaver is not a small spider. It's a giant for a reason. They're absolutely massive. And to have 20 of these things walking around on my head and my face and my eyes is certainly a nerve-wracking experience for myself. Anybody that knows spiders knows that it's not necessarily an aggressive species and it does not have a very potent venom. But for people that are afraid of spiders, that really doesn't matter. So this episode is really directed at helping people maybe overcome their fear of spiders by watching me go through the scenario. I mean, is it going to be a viral hit? We don't know until it comes out. But if this works and the helmet concept catches on with the audience, we've got a handful of other things in the works that could be pretty entertaining.
I definitely look forward to seeing that. That sounds pretty interesting.
It's a good one. Trust me.
I mean, even with all of the spiders and scorpions I have, I don't think I could do that. I think that would freak me out too much. Now, I know you got to go here in a few moments. Just real quick, I wanted to ask, of all the places that you've been, you know, the Sonoran Desert, Costa Rica, Australia, do you have a favorite kind of environment that you always enjoy going back to and exploring?
Well, my favorite place that I've filmed thus far has definitely been Alaska in the grand scheme of things. But what's crazy about that is that Alaska really doesn't have any of the creepy crawly creatures that we so commonly feature on the Brave Wilderness channel. If they just had a bunch more herps and insects and arachnids, it would probably be a location we visited constantly. But when it comes to my favorite place to find the biggest selection of you know, the true creepy crawly creatures, Central America is just one of the best. Every time I visit Costa Rica, I'm finding something that I didn't expect to see. You know, I've been to Australia. They've got just an unbelievable collection of animals there as well. So it all depends really what it is that you're after. And it's tough for me to ever say that one place is specifically my favorite, because every time I go back to a location, I learned something the previous time. And when I return, I'm learning something new and coming up with or seeing a different species. So that's a cool thing about the animal kingdom. It's the gift that just keeps on giving, and you never know what you're going to find next.
That's very cool. Well, I wanted to thank you. I know you got to go. So I appreciate you being willing to come on the podcast and kind of share your experiences with us. I know a lot of people have been very interested in just, you know, how venom affects, you know, the human body. Doctor, did you have anything you wanted to say before Coyote takes off?
No, thank you so much for joining us. We enjoy it. We look forward to your next episodes for sure.
Very cool. Well, no, thank you guys so much for having me on the show. Happy to come back at any time to talk venom. And if it works out, the audience likes it, we've got plenty of other cool helmet ideas in the works.
All right. That's awesome. I look forward to seeing that. All right. Well, it was good to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on, and hopefully we will see you again in the future. Look forward to that video.
Sounds great, guys. Thanks. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you.
That was amazing.
Yeah, that's cool.
So, wow. I don't know about you, but I was a little nervous, and I'm not sure why.
same here. For sure. Yeah. It was good though. I mean, it was nice to have him on for sure.
Definitely. So that was very cool. And you set that up, and I wanted to thank you profusely for that. That was very cool. I had like my whole list of questions here, but you know, he would start talking and in my mind, I would be focusing on what he was saying and forget about, I got to follow this.
I kind of felt the same way. It's like, you ask a question and I was getting distracted and
it was funny. I don't think my son believed that this was actually going to happen. I was telling him, he was like, it's not the same Coyote Peterson. Who is it? And I'm like, no, it really, it's this guy right here. No. He's like, is this actually going to be online where we can watch it? Or is this just like, I'm like, no, it'll be, you can see it. You can listen to the podcast. It'll be for real.
That's awesome.
So yeah, he's at school right now. Or I would have had him come on and say hi, but it's, that's how it goes. But you just kind of getting back to venom. A doctor, have you ever been bitten or stung before? Have you ever experienced anything like Coyote's been through?
No, me personally, I have not been. Yeah. No, I've never been. I mean, you know, I have tarantulas and scorpions and all that, but no, I've never been bitten. Never been haired. I mean, I'm pretty cautious with them, but never been bitten, thankfully. Not too big of a deal.
That's one of the things I enjoy about, you know, watching his videos is, you know, because tarantulas and scorpions and centipedes are so hesitant to bite, especially, you know, I mean, if you're doing what you should be doing in the hobby, you know, you're not gonna have to worry about really getting bit by a tarantula. You know, if you're being mindful and careful, it's not something that's typically going to happen. So it's interesting to actually have some kind of resource where you can see what the effects of that venom would be on the human body. I know that in some circles, his content is a little controversial. You know, some people in the tarantula hobby and exotic pet hobby, it's almost like, I don't want to offend anyone. But you know, there are people out there that just want to kind of ignore the dangerous aspect of exotic pets. You know, like if we don't talk about it's not real. Like everything is safe. There's no level of danger to any of these venomous creatures. Where I think, you know, it's better to talk about that stuff, not just pretend like it doesn't exist, because it may give a shine a bad light on something. I enjoy what he does, and I really enjoy his videos and just the amount of, you know, you're watching his videos and you see that the production value of them, just the way that they're edited and structured is really good. Just the way it kind of hooks you in. It's some very interesting.
Yeah, for sure. They do a great job. And I mean, I'd like to reiterate that the fact that he's been through all these bites and stings and all that, and he's okay. And it takes a lot for them to actually bite you. I think sometimes people think that there's some people that obviously think that every spider is going to bite you. And then there's some people that think that they're all good and nothing's going to happen. There's no hard, fast rule. If you're a little kid or you're an elderly person, you have other medical problems and an HMAC bites you, that's going to be bad. You're going to suffer. If it's your young, healthy person, is going to suck for 14 days, 2-3 weeks. But you'll probably be okay. You're going to have pain. I was actually reading one report where there was a 19-year-old kid that got bit by an HMAC, and he had so much muscle rigidity that they went to give him a shot of pain medication, and the muscles were so rigid they couldn't even get the shot in there. That's pretty crazy.
Go through. That's pretty impressive. Yeah.
The other thing I was reading on the case reports before this podcast was a lot of males who were drunk that ended up getting bit. And, you know, that just reiterates that it's probably people messing with the animals.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. The closest I've ever come to being bit was by a Gramostola rosea. I was like 20, 21, somewhere around that. We'll say I'm 21 for legal reasons. And had a little bit of a house party. I had some friends over. We had been drinking and partying. And, my grandmother used to always say, like, one boy has a brain. Two boys have half a brain, three or more have no brains at all. You know, and there's probably like seven or eight of us there at the house. So there wasn't a brain cell among us. And I always found it interesting that some of, you know, I'm hanging out with these rough and tumble rough and tumble. That doesn't sound tough at all. But hanging out with, like, you know, some tough dudes.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're at my house and scared to death of the sweet, cute little spider that I had sitting on my table. So, you know, trying to impress or show off or whatever, I had taken the lid off the enclosure and was trying to, you know, show the tarantula's fangs, get it to, like, kind of go into a threat pose. Mm-hmm. Like I said, that was not a good idea. I was definitely under the influence and, you know, just trying to show off and being an idiot like we are when right. we're young. And it just kind of, as a testament to how docile a lot of tarantula species are, it wasn't doing anything. You know, it was kind of like just kept walking away from me. Had a little paintbrush yeah. or something like that. And I finally crossed the line, you know, after probably like 5 minutes of really pestering this thing, it finally reared up and, you know, and I kept kind of poking it a little bit and it and inevitably, you know, kind of just lunged at me and started crawling up the paintbrush towards my hand. And I panicked like, oh my gosh, had I, you know, not dropped that paintbrush when I did, there's a pretty good chance it would have got my fingers, you know? So it was kind of those. That obviously blew up in my face, but it kind of like gave me a healthy respect for tarantulas. You know, like if I don't bother them, they're not going to be bothering me. You know, if I'm poking and prodding them, then, you know, I'm putting myself in that position. So I could definitely see drunk young men getting bit.
Yeah, it's interesting.
That especially was a lot partying of that. In the desert or something.
For sure. One of the other interesting case reports that I came across was, or not a case report, but a study that I came across was they were studying the different effects of they studied Postlitheria regalis, Serrata jaris darlini, and then one of the Brachypelma species, and they found that the amount of venom it took to kill a cricket, so the most lethal was the Postlitheria, the second was actually the Brachypelma, and they were pretty close, and the third was the Serrata jaris darlini. And it turned out that the darlini, its venom was designed to actually just paralyze the prey, and it didn't actually kill him. So if it injected the cricket, 24 hours later, the cricket would be fine. And so and that kind of plays into the fact that there's different components to the venom, and how it affects the cricket is not how it's going to affect us necessarily.
Yeah.
So they're thinking that the amount of enzymes in the venom that can break down tissue relates to how bad it is for humans. So, you know, there's a lot more studying to do, but I don't think that they're ever going to come up with like treatments because it doesn't really kill anyone. And so there's not a big incentive to do that.
Yeah. It's just kind of the consequences of your actions, and you're going to have to go through that pain. It's not going to kill you. It'll just make you stronger.
Yeah,
that's one of the things about venom that I find so fascinating is that some venom seems to be designed to kill something, you know, as quickly mm-hmm. as possible, while others are more built towards paralyzing. You see that a lot with like the wasps. He was talking about was talking about some of his videos that they don't kill; they just paralyze the tarantula, or they paralyze the cicada for weeks because they're dragging that animal down into their burrow and laying eggs on it, and the larvae are eating them alive. And I mean, it's brutal; it's a brutal existence. But it's interesting how depending on what the venom's being used for, nature has kind of honed it. And into these specific use cases, I guess you could say. And then just the medical research that's being done on some of these venoms, I find fascinating. Like, especially when I'm making videos for species-specific care and husbandry, you know, I doing some research online and come across these reports, you know, I believe it, like I've seen some, I think it was scorpion venom possibly that was being researched for male impotence, like to kind of cure that. I've seen some as cures for cancer, treatments for cancer. There's just all kinds of medicinal properties to some of these.
Yeah. For example, I think the Trinidad chevron, the Cambridge, that one has a component of the venom that numbs. And I think they may be, or at least they were looking at some treatments for neuropathic pain. And so I'm not involved in any research like that or anything like that. And I'm not an arachnologist, I'm just more on the clinical side, but it is very interesting. Yeah. I know that actually pharmaceutical companies will go into like the rainforest and search for these spiders and bugs and that kind of thing to actually look for the components. So it's pretty cool. We'll see what happens.
Now with your medical training and experience, if you were to get, I mean, you mentioned that you had, or maybe no, you said you had not. but personally, I have been hit with urticating hairs multiple times. And you see this a lot on Facebook groups and stuff like that. There's always a post where somebody got some urticating hairs, you know, on their skin, and it's very uncomfortable. They're itching, they're scratching. Sometimes it's burning and, you know, kind of blistering. You know, depending on the person, there can be, and I guess the tarantula, what type of urticating hair it is, you know, because I think there's six different types of setae. You know, it'll have a different effect on your body, but there doesn't seem to be any real way to kind of treat it. You know, like, I mean, personally, I'm extremely sensitive to certain species, and I've tried everything from, you know, wrapping the affected area in duct tape and peeling it off, hoping to kind of like pull some of the urticating hairs out of my skin. I mean, I've gotten desperate. So, I mean, I've tried hot candle wax. I've tried cool water. I've tried mustard. For some reason, someone suggested that. They didn't do anything but make my hands smell like mustard. I've tried vinegar. Let's see, Benadryl, all kinds of anti-itch creams, calamine lotions. I even have like a prescription anti-itch hydrocortisone cream. I've tried that. You know, pretty much anything that anybody's ever suggested online. I've been in a situation at some point, you know, doing something stupid, like scooping substrate out of an old enclosure that had like a tea blondie in it or something, and just getting that hair in between my fingers and be like, ah, oh, that was dumb. Is there any like kind of like a medical treatment to urticating hairs or some way to kind of alleviate that allergic reaction if someone were to experience that?
Yeah. So if you're having an actual allergic reaction to the hairs, which you can have, and people can actually go into anaphylactic shock from tarantula parts lodged in you. And so then in that case, you treat with steroids and Benadryl and all that, but really it's probably still going to itch and it's probably still going to suck. There's no other evidence-based treatment modality. You kind of just have to treat the symptoms, unfortunately. I don't know. Has any of it worked for you?
The hydrocortisone, is hydrocortisone a steroid?
Yeah.
That prescription stuff is, that worked a little bit. Taking Benadryl usually helps me with the swelling. Maybe some ibuprofen I've tried. The worst ones was, the duct tape. Cause I don't think that actually pulled out any urticating hair, just pulled out my hair. So it was like, now it hurts doubly. I've also the hot candle wax. I don't know why I thought that was a good idea. I guess maybe that, you know, you'd pour that on your hand and then it would kind of like cool off. And then when you pulled the wax off, it would pull the hairs out.
And that
actually felt good when I was pouring the hot candle wax on the air, you know, like
that makes sense.
That kind of relieved the initial itching, and pain. But as soon as it cooled and I pulled it off, it was right back. And it was a very momentary relief.
Yeah. So if you think about it, what's happening is the hairs, the barbs are getting under your skin and your body's creating a local allergic reaction, a local histamine release, and that causes severe itching. And so the way to treat it would be you treat the symptoms by giving Benadryl, which blocks histamine, and steroids, which blocks inflammation. Unfortunately, that doesn't really solve the actual problem. It can't get the hairs out, but it just kind of treats the symptoms. So, and those have their own side effects. It's not necessarily always good to take steroids and that kind of thing. The main thing is if it gets in your eyes, that's when you really need to get to a specialist, because you're going to need eye drops and all kinds of things. That's the worst. I would say the best thing is preventing it. If you can prevent it with gloves or some type of barrier protection, is the best way.
Yeah. And there seems to be this kind of like macho man stance in the tarantula hobby. Like, oh, I'm not scared of urticating hairs. Like they don't bother me. And I think I guess what I'm trying to say is like, sometimes I get grief in the comments cause I wear gloves or goggles or something like that. Or talk about, you know, wearing long sleeves and face protection and stuff like that, dealing with some species that are a little more, apt to hair you, I guess I could say. But I don't think that's a good kind of precedence to set. I think it's important to, you know, really kind of take the necessary precautions, because they can be very uncomfortable. And like you said, if it were to get into your eyes, nose, or mouth, you know, that can cause problems, you know, like you see pictures of people, putting tarantulas in their mouth, like New World tarantulas. Right. And I'm like, this is a really bad idea. If that tarantula started kicking hairs inside of your mouth and those hairs were getting in your throat, like I would imagine, I couldn't imagine how uncomfortable that would be.
I mean, these tarantulas develop, they evolve this mechanism to prevent getting eaten, you know, from an animal that's hungry. So they can mess someone up.
Yeah. Now, am I right in the understanding, that you know, say you were to get some urticating hairs on your skin, you know, and those barbs are kind of, you know, like you said, they're shoved down in there and kind of trapped. Now, will the body just start dissolving that over time to get rid of it? Or like how do those urticating hairs finally get off?
So over time, our body actually, we shed our own skin, not like a tarantula molt, obviously, but we shed our skin. And so over time, it slowly will just, it'll get kind of pushed out, if you will, but it would probably take weeks, you know, to get the full thing out. So,
yeah.
And I think it depends on how deep it is really, and how much hair, the load of it and how deep. And so the longer it's in your skin, or the deeper it's in your skin, the longer it's going to take to get out.
Yeah. I've noticed there's definitely a difference in the way my body reacts depending on the species, like Brachypelma bamii, a Theraphosa species. There's another one that really gets me. Which one was it? Lociodora periabana and Acanthoscuria geniculata. Like those species are the ones I'm the most careful around, because there may be other species that will affect me the same, but those are the ones that I've experienced. And I know, I believe it was the bamii. It was like 2 weeks I was dealing with itching. Like the first three or four days were the worst, you know, especially the first couple of days. Cause I mean, it was beyond itching. Like there was welts on my fingers, on my hands, kind of a rash, some swelling, and it was like hot and painful. After that kind of subsided, it was just itchy. And you know, I didn't want to scratch it, but it was just this constant itch for, you know, a couple of weeks. And then even the welts were still there. But then, you know, it slowly started to, the swelling went down and it wasn't itchy anymore. I kind of got through that, and really nothing was helping except for taking Benadryl and ibuprofen and stuff like that.
Right.
You know, but I've had other species like the rosea. I know that it's haired me before. I've gotten some of its hairs on me, some of the Gramostola species, because I can feel the itch, but it's like 24 hours later, I don't feel it anymore. You know, it's Avicularia, I know, has a type 3 urticating hair. So they really got to rub them on you. They don't kick them. And I have seen the Avicularia rubbing its abdomen on me, and I assume, okay, it's hairing me, but then I never have any kind of reaction to it. So it's, you know, and I know that differs from people. I know some people who've been haired by a Brachypelma bamii and had no adverse reaction to the hair at all.
And I think part of that is because it's our own body reacting to the hair. It's not like the hair is emitting some chemical. The hair is just irritating our body, and our body's releasing different kinds of chemicals like histamine. Everybody reacts a little bit differently, kind of like everyone's allergic to different types of things. You know, everyone's a little bit different.
Yeah. There's this, I don't want to say it's like an urban legend, but I don't know how else to describe it. But it gets tossed around a lot in the tarantula hobby, where people are saying, you know, initially they weren't sensitive to urticating hairs, and after keeping tarantulas for a long time, they become more and more sensitive. Is there any medical validity to that? Because like my experience has almost been the opposite, but I was like, there's gotta be some kind of, you know, scientific explanation to whether or not people become more sensitive over time or not.
Yeah. It would actually make sense that you would become more sensitive. So with the first reaction, the first exposure, your body may not react to it. It doesn't recognize the urticating hair. On the second exposure and subsequent exposures, your body then recognizes, hey, this is a foreign body in my skin. I need to get rid of it. I need to shoot out a bunch of chemicals, get some histamine to it, and we need to get it out of here. And so it actually would make sense that you would get sensitized to different types of hair on subsequent exposures. It may be that, you know, you've been exposed before and you never knew it. And then when you were first exposed with your tarantulas, then you were already kind of allergic to it almost.
Yeah, that's very possible. And also I know that when I am exposed, I learn my lesson. So I'm much more careful with that species moving forward. Right. But that's true. So maybe that's what it is. True. Yeah. Like I was getting haired a lot early on, and now I'm like really careful. So I just haven't experienced, it's been a while. It's probably been maybe a year or more since I've actually had to, any issues with urticating hairs. I think the last time was, and then I had a close call when I was filming the Theraphosa sturmi. You know, I had like a couple different cameras on it at the same time. So, you know, my hands are, you know, not where they should be, you know, I guess if I was being extremely cautious, but I believe I was doing a macro shot of the tarantula and had both hands on the front of the camera and was kind of moving it forward. And then I see it through the screen. Like I wasn't even looking at the tarantula, but I saw it kick hairs. And I reacted like the only way I knew how. I just fell backwards. I was like, I got to get my hands out of this enclosure as quickly as possible. Just kind of fell backwards, set the camera down, closed the door, and then just left it alone for a few hours. I was like, I'm going to let those hairs kind of settle. Because you can see that cloud, especially with a large Theraphosa species. You can see it lingering in the air. So I was like, I'm just going to back away.
It sounds like you've just gotten good at avoiding it now. But I think there is validity to the fact that you would become more allergic to it as time goes on.
I gotcha. That's why I was kind of curious about, because I know like other things your body builds up a tolerance for. So it's like you get exposed once, you have a serious reaction. And then the more you do it, I guess my experience, I'm drawing off things like medicine, like drugs and alcohol and stuff like that. You know, you take a painkiller and it works really well. And then, the longer you're on it, the more of a tolerance it kind of builds up in your system. So the more you got to kind of take to get that same level of pain relief. So I thought that type of logic would be applied to urticating hairs.
So in theory, like the way they do allergy shots, so they take a little bit of what you're allergic to and they give it to you slowly over time. And in theory, you do become tolerant to those allergens. But in this case, because you're getting large doses of the urticating hairs all at once, I think it's harder for your body to cope with it.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I kind of touched on this earlier when we were talking with Coyote, but I wanted to get a little bit more in depth with you while we were just talking, just in case somebody's listening, and they're taking care of their tarantulas or their scorpions and, maybe they're feeding them or rehousing or something. They get tagged, especially if it's like by an old world just a very hot scorpion. Initially, like, is it like a snake bite? You can suck the venom out, or is it as soon as it hits you? And that venom's already kind of having an effect on the tissues and getting into your bloodstream.
Right. And so according to what I've read, the studies that you can't really suck it out, but they say applying localized pressure can kind of stop the spread. But so what you want to do initially, so first off, always talk to your doctor. But first off, if you get bit, the first thing you want to do is to make sure that you can get the tarantula back to... it's not going to tag you again. Let's make sure that it's not going to hit you again. Get away from the area. And then you want to make sure that you're breathing okay. Your lips aren't swelling, your tongue's not swelling, that kind of thing. If that's not happening, then you can kind of decipher, well, what did I get bit by? Is it something that's going to cause severe problems? Is it something just like a brachypelma that's maybe not going to cause severe problems? If it is going to cause severe problems, you probably would want to talk to your doctor, get to the hospital to make sure that you can get IV fluids, pain medicine, the cramps don't get too severe, that kind of thing. Yeah. If it's a species where it's not going to really cause any problems, I'd say you can probably wait it out. Probably just stay hydrated and do all that. Make sure you're not going to have any subsequent allergic reactions. Now, if it's a black widow or brown recluse, again, make sure that you're not going to get tagged again. Make sure you get out of the area, make sure you're not having any anaphylactic reactions. And then I don't think it's urgent that you would necessarily have to seek medical care immediately unless you were going to have any severe symptoms, just because they're not really going to be able to do anything other than in symptomatic treatment. Now, down the line, if you develop an infection or something like that, that is possible and you may need antibiotics. Again, always talk to your doctor and seek appropriate medical care.
Okay. So say I got tagged, first thing to do then would apply pressure. So like a compression straps or like a ACE bandage or something like that, kind of wrap that around the area to kind of constrict the blood flow.
Correct. Wash it off, make sure it's clean and then apply pressure.
Okay. And as far as, say it's, I don't want to pick on a species, but an old world tarantula bites me. And I start experiencing the pain. I did the compression. I washed it off, all that kind of stuff. Is there any, can I take ibuprofen, Benadryl, anything like that kind of relieve any of the symptoms or maybe like take the edge off at all? Or is it pretty much it's going to hurt and you're going to go through it?
Oftentimes they'll recommend ibuprofen or Tylenol or something like that. If it's an allergic reaction, they might recommend Benadryl. Otherwise, Benadryl won't do too much. So more just Advil, Tylenol. As long as there are no other contraindications, you don't have any other personal medical problems that you can't take those medications for.
other than like maybe your throat tightening or kind of getting anaphylactic response, are there any other like levels of pain or swelling or anything that would be kind of an indicator that, all right, you can't handle this on your own, you need to go to the hospital?
Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, if you're having severe muscle spasms and rigidity, one of the things they can do is they can give you IV magnesium, and that can help relieve spasms. They can give you IV calcium sometimes to replace your calcium, because the venom causes a lot of electrolyte shifts in your body. And so sometimes replacing those electrolytes through the IV can help. That's one thing. Another thing is you want to make sure that you can maintain your own hydration. And so if you're having severe muscle spasms or you can't even eat or drink or anything like that, you probably would want to seek care so that you can, you know, stay hydrated.
Yeah, it's something that I've always kind of wondered about. You know, I know that, you know, you go out hiking or something like that, you have a snake bite kit in case you, like a rattler bites you or something like that. And mm-hmm. I've always wondered if maybe I should have something, you know, just for safety's sake down here in the basement, you know, kind of like a kit put together in the rare, extremely rare circumstance, you know, or situation where I might get bit or stung. If you were to kind of put something like that together, is there anything you would suggest including in a kit like that?
Yeah. So, you know, if you go by the books, that there's not a real evidence that any of those venom extractors work too much, any studies that I know of. But I also think that there's not a lot of harm to it, so it's something worth trying. But other than that, just compression, probably having an ACE wrap, maybe a cooling pack, and having some ibuprofen, Tylenol handy, that kind of thing would probably help.
I might do that. And even though I've never had any worries, ibuprofen can be hard to come by at my house. It seems like everybody's you take the last of it. Don't mention it's all gone until you need it. It's like, well, I got a headache and now I got to go to the store. So thank you for that.
Maybe a little Neosporin to put on there so that the actual puncture wounds don't get infected.
So have you ever, you know, working in the medical field, you know, being a doctor at a hospital, have you ever had anyone come in and had to treat like a brown recluse bite or a black widow bite or anything like that?
Yeah. So most of the time, a lot of times people will complain of, I got bit by a spider, and I always go through the questions about whether or not they saw the spider, if they were able to capture it. And actually most of the time, 99% of the time, never. So whenever they come in like that, you just take a look at, and usually if you, a brown recluse bite will be a red patch or a red flat area. In the middle, there might be some pallor or whiteness. And then in the middle of that, there might be a little black necrotic area. If it's not infected, you don't really have to do too much. You just kind of treat it symptomatically. And I'm sorry, what was your original question? I kind of went off tangent.
I was just wondering if you had ever had to treat any kind of venomous bites in the hospital.
Yeah. So we have treated what people say might be venomous bites, but you know, most of the time they can actually never confirm. And so I would say personally, I've never had a confirmed case of a spider bite, black widow or brown recluse, only people thinking they might have had the bites.
Yeah. I see that on Facebook all the time. So I was like, I got bit by a brown recluse. It's like, you live in Canada or Maine. I seriously doubt there's a huge population of brown recluse outside of their kind of endemic area.
A lot of times, so you'll hear, I mean, so many people complain of spider bites, but by official medical terms, it's never a confirmed bite. It's always a suspected bite. And so, yeah, I've treated a ton of suspected bites, but they've never been confirmed. And the treatment is, you know, it could just be antibiotics, or there's not a whole lot else to do, pain control. And so there's no anti-venom here. And so most of the time it's nothing too big.
Now in the tarantula keeper's guide, or I usually have it sitting right here. That's what it's called. The tarantula keeper's guide. Is that right? Or the tarantula keeper's handbook, whatever that book is. It actually has a section where it's talking about tarantula bites and stuff like that. And it suggests that if you were to get bit, to capture the spider, you know, so if like my P. Metallica bit me, it's suggesting that I capture it and take it with me to the hospital to show them. Like, as a doctor, is that a good idea or is that a bad idea?
You know, in one sense, I understand what they're saying, because I feel like a lot of doctors aren't going to believe you. you know, I got bitten by a South Asian bird spider, tree spider. They're going to be like, well, you know, they're going to be confused. And so they may take you more seriously, but on the other hand, you know, you don't want to get tagged again. You don't want to capture it in the meantime, you know, get tagged twice. So if you can't easily get it, then I would say leave it. But otherwise, yes, it might be able to help in terms of getting a game plan going and making sure that they don't look for other things. You know, they you come in and say you got bit by a P. metallica and they don't believe you, and then they start looking for other diagnoses. You don't want that either. So I understand what they're saying. So I would say as long as you can safely take it with you, it might help in the hospital.
Yeah, I figured that it would definitely prove to them that you're telling the truth. Like, hey, I've got it right here. This is what bit
right.
You know, and you had mentioned that right. To be diagnosed as a spider bite, usually you want them to catch the black widow or the brown recluse to kind of do correct. That. But it seemed like we're talking about large old world tarantulas. Mm-hmm. It can be difficult to catch them, especially if you've just been bitten mm-hmm. and you're by yourself. But I was just wondering, as you know, from a doctor's perspective or somebody like that's in the medical profession, if I were to just like take a picture of it or show you, like, you know, like my case in particular, like if I was like, look, I have all of these tarantulas, like you can believe that.
Yeah.
You know, would that.
Yeah.
Would you believe that if I came in, you didn't know me from Adam, and I showed you pictures on my phone of a whole bunch of tarantulas and like, this is the one that bit me? Or would you just think I was crazy?
Honestly, I think it could go either way. The thing is, in the ER, we see all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy stuff. And so people are, you know, there's some people that are genuine and some aren't. And so, you know, if they come up with a really crazy story, you might end up going on a tangent and thinking they're on drugs or something. So, you know, it might help, actually, as long as you can do it safely.
Yeah. I've always like kind of played that out in my mind, like, especially during a rehousing or something, you know, like if this goes sideways and I were to get bit, you know, the hospital is like less than a mile away. I can like almost go, you know, look at my backyard and see the hospital, you know? So it's like, I can get there quick, you know, I don't got to worry about that. But my biggest fear is actually interacting with the medical staff, like explaining to them how I got bit and why and by what, you know, like that just seems like a ridiculous conversation to have. And they're not going to believe me. And if they do believe me, then they're just going to think I'm an idiot and I did this to myself and have like no sympathy or compassion. And maybe I don't deserve any, but you know, that's something that I worry about.
I think I could see that going that way in some cases. I feel like I'm biased just because I am aware of the hobby and the field. And so I'm more likely to believe someone, especially if they were able to spit out all the scientific names and things like that. But other people, they might need a little bit more convincing. I'd agree with that.
Now, is there like any, like say I were to get bit and I went to the hospital and, you know, explained it, they believed me, they're treating me. As far as like a doctor, like, are you required to report that bite to local like government agencies or law enforcement or anything like that? Like, is there a possibility I could get in trouble for, you know, being envenomated?
No. That wouldn't be a concern about getting in trouble. There is, we may call the, the local toxicology poison control, and they may advise on certain things, especially in the events of like snake bites and things like that. But it's not reported and you can't get in trouble off that. Yeah. No.
I mean, that's something I've always worried about. I've done research into local laws and state laws and stuff like that. So like, I know I'm good there, but you know, there's always that, that concern that if something were to happen and I were to be envenomated, mm-hmm. That there would be some kind of like mandatory reporting and then I'd have to be dealing with, I mean, who knows what government organization that was to come in. So I didn't know exactly where HIPAA, you know, privacy kind of laws and mandated reporting, like where, you know, getting bit kind of fell in there.
Even if you had an illegal species or something like that, you got bit. I mean, no, I can't go tell the patient is my priority, not the laws or the cops. So, you know, I gotta make sure the patient's safe. And no, I wouldn't worry about getting in trouble from that standpoint.
Interesting. Yeah, it's good to know. Cause I mean, maybe it's just my personality, but I'm always like, I'm always hesitant to go to the doctor. Like that's no matter what, like my wife is constantly, I tweeted about it the other day. She's like, I'm like, I don't have been sick. And she's like, well, you may make your appointment with the doctor. And I'm like, no, I don't want you to do that. I'm not dying. She's like, well, you should go and get checked out. I'm like, I was just there like 6 months ago. She's like, man, you should probably go back. Just like, Jesus.
Yeah.
So like I already kind of have that aversion to doctors for whatever reason. And then when you lay on top of it that, you know, I've done something stupid and have hurt myself and now something that I love could possibly be at risk. It's like, yeah, I definitely don't want to go to the hospital now. So it's,
yeah,
I appreciate you telling me that, 'cause that kind of puts my mind at ease. Like I won't be as scared going to the doctor. Like, am I getting trouble or something like that?
No, we always put the, at least we're trained to, supposed to put the patients first, and we do. I mean, I haven't seen any case that's gotten the patient in trouble or anything like that.
It's just kind of, it's something that when you're keeping exotic pets, you just kind of got to be aware of, that they are venomous and they're not aggressive. They're not going to, I mean, most, I guess I can't speak for all species, but when you're talking about tarantulas and scorpions, for at least, and most snakes, maybe not venomous snakes. I shouldn't talk about stuff I don't know. I'm not a huge snake person, but I will just stick with the inverts. I know that they're not going out of their way to hurt you unless you've really upset them or irritated them, right, or invading their space.
Right.
If you were to get, if someone were to get bit, is there any kind of like medical or scientific, what's the right word here? Benefits to documenting that? Like, I know a lot of people like to document the symptoms and how, like at what time after the bite they kind of had these onset of symptoms to use in bite reports for like arachnoboards. But is there anywhere, you know, scientifically that is also looking for that kind of information that you could?
Yeah, I think there are arachnologists who are looking for case reports of bites and things like that, especially if you can verify it. If you can verify it, then I've seen a bunch of case reports on specific bites, and then that would allow scientists to possibly develop treatments if we ever needed to, you know, in the future.
Yeah.
But I think that's more on the arachnology side, not necessarily the medical side.
Yeah, I found it interesting watching Coyote's videos that he hadn't been bit by a tarantula. Like I was really searching, searching hard on YouTube and Google, like there's gotta be at least one. A lot of them where he's found them and he's handled them and stuff like that, but never been bit. And you know, not having been bit myself, I always in my mind, especially with like Lossiodora periabana or Goliath bird eaters and use the large terrestrial tarantulas, I am definitely a lot more afraid of the fangs than I am the venom.
Yes.
Because I mean those are some massive fangs. I just think they would hurt really bad and really tear into you.
Yeah. Exactly.
And now if you were to get bit by one of those, like say my T. Sturmi decided to take a chunk out of my finger and the venom isn't really doing anything that's causing me pain, but I just have a nasty, is that considered a laceration or what? I don't even know what the medical scientific term for that would be. Yeah. Puncture.
A puncture wound.
What's the best way to kind of, address that from a first aid stance?
You wash it out with soap and water, make sure it's real clean. Got to make sure your tetanus shot is up to date, just cause that's always a concern with any breakage of skin or any cut. And then after that, just local wound care. So I would keep the area nice and clean with some Neosporin, wash it twice daily with soap and water, keep it bandaged up and nice and moist in a moist environment. Maybe keep it like moist with the Neosporin ointment, would facilitate wound healing. And then if from there you get surrounding redness, a fever, swelling, that kind of thing, you might need to seek medical care because it could get infected.
So the fever and the swelling would kind of be the indications.
Fever, swelling, increasing pain, any pus, purulent discharge.
Gross. Yeah. I hope I never have to experience that. And I've also been curious, we know that venom affects people differently based on their health, you know, so like elderly people or young kids, children may have a more adverse effect or a reaction to the venom. But is there anything like a healthy young adult, or maybe not healthy, but, you know, like an adult is to get bit? Are there any kind of like health issues that would make them more susceptible to that venom being dangerous? Like, I mean, things like diabetes or autoimmune disorders, or is there any kind of like pre-existing conditions that would make you more vulnerable to the effects of venom?
Right. There's no studies on this, but you would assume that anyone with a liver or kidney problems would have a hard time getting that toxin out of them. And so I think especially kidney problems would have to be a little bit more careful. And then things like diabetes. So diabetes impairs wound healing. And so if you do get bit by a large spider with big fangs, the wound healing may be kind of difficult, especially if it were on the toes or extremities and that kind of thing. And so you'd want to pay attention to wound healing in diabetics, especially. Other than that, if you're, you know, chronically ill, you are always going to be more susceptible just because your body has less reserves. But there's no other like specific medical conditions that are cited in the textbooks that put you at increased risk other than that.
So things like, I just trying to extrapolate from what you were saying, like cirrhosis of the liver, hepatitis E, would like HIV or cancer or anything like that make you, your immune system a lot?
Yeah, those would put you more at risk for any like secondary infections like HIV, diabetes, cancer, because you're on chemotherapeutic agents that can also impair wound healing. Those put you at risk for secondary infections. So after you get bit, you have bacteria on your skin that live there normally. The fangs puncture your skin and push the bacteria deeper into your tissues. The bacteria breeds in your tissues and you get an infection. So anything that can put your risk for infection in that case can be problematic.
And do you have like any insight or information on exactly how venom like affects the body? You know, I know a tarantula bites me and it injects the venom, like the venom is secreted from its fangs and it goes into my body. But like once it's in my body, I don't really know how the venom is reacting. Like, is it attacking my muscles and my skin? Is it getting in my blood? Like, I mean, how does, are you familiar with the science behind that? Or is that?
Yeah. So, each spider is different, obviously. So, we'll just take the regalis, postlithera regalis. It has some enzymes in there that break down your connective tissue. The connective tissue is the tissue around your cells. And then that allows the venom to kind of seep deeper into your cell and attack your cells. And specifically it attacks the potassium sodium pumps in your cells. And that can cause neurological problems and cause paralysis and cause death to the nerves and then muscles. And then you can't move. And that's why you get muscle cramps. So each spider is different though, and that's just one example. Other spiders might attack the muscle cells, like the brown recluse will actually cause the muscle cells or the skin cells to actually die. And it doesn't attack the nerves as much.
So it's more just kind of dissolving. Is it kind of like the assassin bugs, like their venom just dissolves muscle and tissue and stuff like that.
Right.
It turns into a...
Yeah, a lot of the venoms act on the sodium, potassium channels in your cell and cause the electrolytes to be imbalanced. And then that electrolyte imbalance causes your nerves to not function correctly.
So what causes the stiffness in joints, especially like long-term, like the aching and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think that a lot of the long-term things are just related to chronic inflammation. The muscle spasms are related to the venom acting on the nerves, and the nerves cause the muscles to fire all the time, and that causes them to cramp up. And then after that, your body's just kind of fighting the chronic inflammation, and the same thing that would make you kind of sick with the flu, all the inflammatory changes are happening in your body to get rid of the flu. It's kind of the same thing in this case. There's a lot of inflammation to get rid of the venom.
Yeah. I always kind of thought it was cool that, to keep these, like, I keep looking at my bark scorpions over here. Because I appreciated their venom toxicity and I knew it was painful, but it wasn't really until I was, rewatching a lot of Coyote's videos that he was talking about how he wouldn't get stung by a bark scorpion. Like I knew that when I was talking to him, like he got stung by the giant hairy and the striped tail and he wasn't going to get stung by the bark because it was so much more painful and potentially dangerous. But when I think of my scorpions, especially the bark scorpions, like even though I know they're the most venomous scorpion in the US at least, I feel like maybe I don't give them the respect that they deserve when I'm interacting with them or feeding them. And I don't know. I don't know why that is. Like to me, they're cool little scorpions, you know, they're just kind of running around hanging out.
People report over here, it's a brown recluse. Everyone says got a brown recluse bite. Everyone.
Yeah.
I don't, you know.
Yeah, I had a couple of friends, back where I grew up who were, telling everybody they got bit by a brown recluse. And the reality was they had MRSA, and for whatever reason, they were ashamed to say I have MRSA. So they just said it was a brown recluse. I'm like, man, that's not cool to brown recluses. That's not cool to spiders in general. Yeah,
it's one of the differentials. The other one is, actually herpes. People get herpes outbreaks and they blame it on spiders, but really it's just herpes.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I would think if that were the case, I would tell people, I got a spider bit my lip. That's not an STD.
Well, there's a herpes that you can get on your fingers. And so it's called herpetic Whitlow. And so they blame it on spiders all the time, but really it's just herpes.
Yeah. It's funny. With scorpions, the bark scorpion, I need to probably be more mindful with and appreciate or respect more, give up their space, because his reaction to them was a lot more hesitant and cautious than mine is interacting with them on a daily basis. But then on the other hand, there are other species that I have, like some of the Brazilian scorpions, that I'm extremely careful with, tiny little guys, because I know that they mm-hmm. can really cause a whole lot of pain. And for a while I had a Deathstalker scorpion, and I don't remember if I ordered it or if somebody just sent it to me. Like, I placed an order and they threw it in. I'll have to go back and watch those videos to remember. But I was terrified. Same with like centipedes. And it's one of those things that personally I would rather not keep, an exotic pet that I was that afraid of or worried about. Like the Deathstalker scorpion looks really cool, but it ended up passing away. The one that was sent to me, had some health issues. I guess it was kept in, an environment that was just too humid. So it had, it had developed some issues and only lived for a few weeks after I got it. There was really not much I could do about it. I had reached out to a lot of people like, hey, this is the problem. They're like, if it survives to the next molt, then you'll be okay. But if it doesn't molt, it's going to die. And it ended up dying. But I never replaced it. And a lot of people were asking me, hey, do a video on the Deathstalker. But where I'm at right now, I'm not comfortable having something with that toxic venom in the house. And I think that's something that really we should really talk about a lot more in the hobby. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're not comfortable keeping something, don't. it's not a badge of honor. Like, you're not any less of a keeper because you don't want to have a postletharia. Like, I feel like they're beautiful tarantulas, and and like we discussed, they're not going to go out of their way to harm you. Anytime you're going to get bit or stung by anything is when you're making a mistake or you're provoking them and kind of backing them into a corner, but you're going to make a lot more mistakes. I feel like personally, I just keep it on myself. I know I make a lot more mistakes when I'm like really nervous and second guessing myself and just scared, when your hands are shaking, and you're uncomfortable, you're more likely to you're not going to be confident, I guess is what I'm trying to say. That I don't know if the trench look and, sense that fear or exactly how that works, but that's for me. I'm not going to keep a venomous snake or spider or scorpion or anything that I'm uncomfortable interacting with, to the point that I may make a mistake.
I was going to say the other thing to be cautious of is who else is in your house. If you're going to have it, can potentially escape and hurt someone in your house, it might you might want to rethink that, might want to find a different home for that animal, no matter what it is.
Yeah. And that was like, with the Deathstalker that I had, even though it wasn't doing really well and it was having a hard time moving around, I mean, from the moment I unpacked it, I still like doubled up its enclosure. Like, I had it in an enclosure and then had that enclosure in something else, and get in just like the rare, chance that it somehow was able to escape, it would then be in the, I was like, I'm going to be really careful. Right. Just because I was nervous about it. And I've got, at the time, I think Ryan was like, my son was 10 or somewhere around there. And I was like, my luck, it would escape and end up stinging him or something like that and step on it. And I just didn't want that guilt. So that's kind of like been my mindset, is if I'm afraid to the point that I'm going to double enclosure or something, maybe I shouldn't have that here. Same with like the, I had a black widow for a while. I think it was Tanya over at Fear Not Tarantulas threw one in on, an order I'd placed years ago. And it was I was surprised. And I think that I bought into a lot of the hype and misconceptions about black widow spiders and was like, this is a deadly spider. And my wife's like, you can't have that in the house. And I'm like, well, why not? You know, like, we've got all these other tarantulas and scorpions, but that was one of her lines. She's like, no, you can't have that in the house. So I actually brought that to work. And it was like on my desk for a long time, my pet black widow spider. But, you know, it's one of those things, the more I learned about it, the less afraid of them I became.
Correct.
You know, because it's like, okay, they're not nearly as dangerous as maybe the media or just, you know, just kind of the perception of them are.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, that can be said with a lot of different venomous species, but it's like, for me, if it's something that I'm going to keep out of the house, or, you know, I'm afraid might kind of, you know, sting or bite my child and cause them some serious issues. I'm not comfortable keeping them here, I guess. Like, it's not that important to add them to my collection. And
right.
I think that there should be no shame in that. I think that, you know, if somebody says I'm uncomfortable keeping an old world tarantula, then that's just how it is. That, okay, you're uncomfortable. That's not a problem. We're not going to shame you for it, you know? And maybe after, you know, you learn more and you become more confident in keeping tarantulas over time, you'll possibly work up the experience and the courage to keep something like that. But I mean, have you kind of, I mean, what's your experience on, you know, keeping old world tarantula? Like, I know you've got a centipede and a scorpion and stuff like that. Like, how do you base how hot or how potent of a venom that your creatures have in your house?
So, you know, I have a bunch of kids at home, and so definitely keep them all up in a room that's locked and nobody else goes in there. And so, that's one of the ways we can prevent any issues from happening. And then anytime we need to rehouse anything, we're just extra cautious and take all the, safety precautions, don't really handle too much and that kind of thing. And I think that's helped in staying safe, but I totally agree with you that, if you're not comfortable with keeping something, don't do it. If you can't keep it safely, then don't do it. You know, you don't want to end up in the hospital for no reason, or end up trying to, you know, get a kid stung or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, the people who are actually susceptible to the bites and stings, you would especially want to keep them safe. I'd agree.
Yeah. And speaking of having a lot of kids, you all just had a baby. Congratulations. How's your baby doing?
Yeah, he's 2 weeks old now, just over 2 weeks. And so doing good. We're busy, staying busy.
Yeah. So I'm assuming it's probably been about 2 weeks since you had a good night's sleep.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. But I always find I feel bad for people online, to kind of get back to what we were talking about. They'll have like an OBT or an HMAC or something like that. And I think as tarantula keepers or exotic pet keepers, sometimes we don't think about all the different ways something can escape. Like, well, we got in a good enclosure, it's locked up, we know it's safe in there. We forget about the fact that we have a very curious cat that likes to push things off shelves, you know, and it seems to be that happens more often than you would like to maybe admit, that a cat pushes an enclosure off, especially like spiraling or juvenile enclosures. And now all of a sudden you've got an old world baboon spider or something running through your house, and people are freaking out. Like, how do I catch my OBT or HMAC is loose in my house, I'm scared to death. You know, and it's like, there's at this point, there's not a whole lot you can do. Like, you can look for, you know, good places that it would be hiding. But if I feel like prevention is the best kind of way of, to avoid getting bitten by some of these spiders. If you have cats or dogs, or, I mean, even snakes, if you let your snakes out, kind of free roam through your, you know, reptile room or whatever, you want to make sure that your enclosures are not just escape proof from the tarantula, but also tip over proof. I don't know if that's an actual phrase, but it's secure. You know, you've got it somewhere where you don't have to worry about it getting pushed up, pushed off a shelf or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd agree. I mean, prevention is the best, because if you get bitten by an HMAC, you might not die, but you're going to feel pretty crappy for a few weeks. And there's, you know, honestly, not a whole lot we can do at the hospital and give you pain medications, but you know, how long is that going to last? Right. So,
especially these, like, nobody likes to give out pain medicine anymore, because I mean, it's destructive.
Yeah, exactly.
But I have like a lot of my scorpions. I mean, a lot of them are very young, so they're small. But and most of the ones that are, you know, more hot than I'm, you know, maybe comfortable with keeping out in the open. I have in my spiderling nursery, one because it's just a warmer environment. So, you know, they benefit from that as well. But I also, it's a cat proof environment because we got, I guess maybe about 6 months ago or so, we got a new kitten. And, you know, we had a cat for, I mean, as long as I can remember. And he does not, he likes the snakes. Like he'll maybe crawl up on top of the snake enclosure and watch it slithering around. But as far as the tarantulas, he has no interest in them at all. Has never jumped up on the shelves or messed with their enclosures or anything like that. Now this kitten, on the other hand, you know, it just, it's a cat. So it likes to crawl, like, you know, kind of jump up to the highest point in the room so it can just kind of perch up there and watch.
Right.
And gets curious when it sees things moving in enclosures. So I've caught it more than once messing around with tarantula enclosures. Even had one instance where it had jumped up on a shelf, and when it jumped down, it kicked an enclosure, and that enclosure ended up falling on the ground and breaking, and the tarantula got out. I talked about that on the podcast before. So, you know, it's any species that I have that it's old world or has hot venom, just because I have that cat, I have make sure that those enclosures are as secure as possible. You know, like I've got them, and there's a lot of different ways. I've seen people put straps around their shelves so that, you know, the enclosure can't fall off, and just, you know, different kind of rack systems, and you just got to be creative. Like there's nothing that's commercially made, right? I guess, but I did recently rehouse my centipede. Like I've been wanting to make a video on the centipede for a while, and it's not even like a really scary centipede. I think it's like the best beginner centipede out there. It's with the tiger. What do they call it? The tiger, the desert centipede, Arizona desert centipede, tiger centipede, something like that. You know, it's not, it's very common, species out in Arizona. And I'm sure it would hurt if it were to bite me, but those things are like escape artists from what I've heard.
Yeah.
And it's probably the only species in my collection that my wife is, very kind of upset about me having.
Yeah, for sure. I heard, I mean, you know, ours is just tiny because it was it's a baby. What do they call them? What do they call baby centipedes? I forget.
I have no idea, to be honest.
Yeah, it's just a baby, so it's not that big of a deal. But the bigger ones I hear are escape artists, and so I get a lot of questions about the enclosures. But I think they require like a lot taller enclosures.
Yeah. I mean, they like to burrow. Like I like to keep mine. Yeah. You know, they're tricky because you know you need to give them like 4 or 5 inches of substrate. You know, so they can really burrow down, but, you know, also I guess maybe just from an escape, kind of to avoid escapes because they're pretty strong and they can really stretch up, you know, it's, you got to give them plenty of height. But even like, I mean, I've used aquariums, to keep them in before, and they can actually climb up the silicone in the corner. If they, you know, they can sometimes kind of get a grip on that and use that to climb right up. So you got to make sure you got a good lid on there. The one I have is, I don't know if it's a juvenile or what you would call it. It's not full grown. It's still kind of small. And I actually have it in one of the large tarantula crib enclosures currently.
Okay.
Just because I kind of want to try it out. See how it would work. I got another, I'm like building another enclosure out of a large aquarium for it. Trying to make like this, because I never see it. You know, I know they burrow a lot, but I thought maybe if I can create this like kind of a much larger environment with a lot of like kind of cover, like a little bunch of leaves on the ground and branches and cork bark and stuff like that, a more naturalistic kind of vivarium that it might maybe come out more often and be moving around. So as I'm setting that up, I kind of put it in this tarantula cribs enclosure and have been keeping an eye on it because I was really curious how the sliding locking doors on your enclosures, how the centipede would react to that, if it would be able to open it or anything like that. And in the first 24 hours, I guess I had a GoPro on it filming the entire time. Cause I was like, if this guy can get out, I want to see it, how it did it, you know, cause I can't, from my mind, I can't figure out how it would. And, it's been there for about a week now and it has not escaped. Like I've seen it try, you know, it kind of goes up the side in the corner and I can see it trying to wedge, but I mean, between the magnets and the fact that they're kind of in those tracks, I don't think that it has at least it hasn't figured it out yet, any way to open that up. So I'm feeling pretty secure about that.
Yeah. I have not tested out the enclosure with the centipede. So officially my official answer is I'm not sure. We'll see what you find.
I'll give it a few more days and move it into its new enclosure. But so far it seems to be working really well. I mean, this is, it was an interesting topic. I know a lot of people were very curious about it, and I'm glad that you were willing to come on. And I think it's awesome that you were able to get Coyote Peterson to agree to come on.
Yeah.
I told a few people. I told like Alex from Tarantula Haven, Amy from Pet Rock and Roll. And then I think like I mentioned it yesterday, I believe, to like a Patreon members and stuff like that. Okay. And pretty much everybody's just kind of been like my kid, like, what? There's no way you did that. Like, why in the world would he come on your podcast?
That was pretty cool. Random luck, I guess.
I was like, well, it's all. So could maybe you just, do you mind telling us like how this all came about? Cause I'm sure people are curious.
Yeah. So my son's a big fan of, Coyote Peterson. And so I reached out to him through the Cameo app. I don't know if you're familiar with it. You can like get celebrities or YouTubers to like say shout out and say happy birthday or something like that. So for my son's birthday, we did that. And so, I just reached out to him through there, during that process, and he was totally cool with it, which is awesome.
Yeah. It shocked me. I remember when you mentioned it to me, we had been talking about doing this, this podcast, just you and I talking about Venom and stuff like that. And you were like, well, how would you feel if, about maybe like seeing if Coyote Peterson wanted to come on and talk about his experience? It's like, yeah, that would be awesome, but there's no way in the world one, he would agree to do it, or two, we'd be able to even get a hold of him. And you're like, well, actually I've already talked to him. It's like, oh, well then yes.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. That was neat for sure.
That was
definitely nervous, but it was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't think I would be nervous, to be honest. Like I wasn't really nervous at all yesterday thinking about it, talking about it, but, I don't know. Once we started talking to him and having that conversation, it was just a surreal moment. Like, oh man, this guy knows what he's talking about. He's actually been out in the field and do these things. And I really, I respected the man's following. Like he's really done some impressive stuff just as far as like, I mean, even if just look at his YouTube videos, like the production value is really good. He's got a good understanding of filmmaking. I believe he studied filmmaking in school. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. I'm still, my tongue is all tied up. I definitely respect that, those aspects of what he does and how he was able to kind of transition from being a YouTuber to like having shows on Animal Planet, you know, like that, that's a cool transition to be able to go from YouTube, video creator, you know, personality to, cable television. And I mean, I wanted to ask him like, one of the first times I ever saw him was, he was on, Conan O'Brien. He brought a tarantula Van Kroon and stuff, and Jeff Goldblum sitting next to him on the couch. And I was like, man, that's surreal. They're like being between Conan O'Brien and Jeff Goldblum. And I was going to bring that up, but I was like, yeah, I don't know if that would be, I was like, I don't know if that's that might be a tasteless thing to ask. What was it like to meet Jeff Goldblum? I don't want to be a dork, but yeah, that's kind of how I was introduced to him. I was like, who is this guy? And check out his YouTube channel. Like, oh, wow. This guy's got going on.
Yeah. Well, he said he's happy to come back, so you can have him on again sometime.
Yeah. It would be a little less I don't even know if nervous is just intimidated. I don't know the right word, but yeah, that was off my game. That's what I've kind of felt like. Just like,
I felt the same way.
Yeah.
I feel the same way.
I'm going to blame my kid, cause he's the one that psyched me out. Like I was totally cool until he is, just telling me how much better he likes Coyote Peterson than me. Just, come on. You're my kid. You gotta support me. Just like, well, why don't you go out and do stuff like that? I would watch your YouTube channel if it was exciting and fun to watch like this. And I'm like, yeah, but I mean, he's going out and showing you what happens when you get bit, you know, and going out in the wild. Like I'm doing the exact opposite. I'm showing you kind of how not to get bit and how to take care of these things in the safety of your own home. But I am excited because, I was talking to, Tanya at Fear Not Tarantulas. We were talking in the comments of a post on Facebook or something. And she had mentioned she was heading out to the Sonora Desert this summer. And, was going to do, I guess they did that a year or so ago. And I was like, just jokingly, you know, I was like, oh, you should totally take me with you this time. She was like, sure. Yeah, we can do that. I'm like, whoa, I'm going to the Sonoran Desert. So I've kind of looking forward to going out and filming some videos, yeah, cool. Hunting centipedes and scorpions, yeah, and tarantulas in the wild.
Yeah. Make sure to put that up. That'll get some views, I bet.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to intentionally get bit or anything like that, but yeah, but I've tried that a few times in the past. Like when we were out in LA, we went out a few times, and I had no luck, you know. It's, but I think the difference between what I'm doing and, you know, especially what Coyote Peterson is doing, you know, he's got days where he's out there. Like you mentioned, it took him a few days to find those bullet ants. And I know from watching some of his videos in the Sonoran Desert, they're out there, you know, for days looking for a tarantula hawk or a centipede or something like that. Where I had like a few hours. It's like, I'll go out in the desert or on Tarantula Hill. I got like an hour or two and I don't find anything. It's like, okay, well, that's the video. Me walking through, not finding anything. So it'll be cool to like actually have 2 or 3 days, or I don't even know how long we're going to be out there, but having like a good chunk of time where pretty much all we're doing is going out in the desert and looking for these species. And
that's pretty cool.
I'm pretty stoked about it. Hopefully I've learned enough from this podcast that I can avoid getting envenomated by anything and know what to do if that were to happen.
Just take a little first aid pack. Should be good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have a feeling that it's probably more difficult to get bit by something in the wild than it is, you know, interacting with it in your own collection. You know, 'cause they have got a lot more room to run and that's their environment. They know the places to go and hide and how they can escape from you, where, you know, we're keeping tarantulas and snakes and stuff like that. You know, they don't have any really means of escape. They go to a defensive nature, a lot quicker. And that's something that I've talked about in other videos, you know, on my YouTube channel is, you know, like for instance, the OBT, a lot of people are like, that's a very aggressive, scary, dangerous spider, and constantly showing pictures and videos of their OBT, like in a threat pose and slapping the ground and all this kind of stuff, where mine is I wouldn't handle it or anything like that, but I've never had an issue with it. Like it's one of my more docile tarantulas because I have its enclosure set up in a way that has plenty of room, plenty of places to hide. So if I'm disturbing it and, you know, instead of giving me a threat pose, it's got plenty of places to, you know, kind of dart into and hide. And, you know, it's a much safer way of interacting with them than just kind of, and I'm not knocking anybody that keeps their enclosure, keeps their tarantulas like in a Tupperware bin with just like a hide and some substrate. Like a lot of people do that and have no problems, but I find when you give them a lot of decorations and places to web up and stuff like that, a lot of hides, more than just one, they seem to be a lot more docile and a lot less prone to give you a threat pose or try to slap or strike at you.
Yeah, I agree.
But well, we're coming up on the 2-hour mark, so we have to wrap this up. Is there anything you wanted to say before we finish the podcast?
No, I just wanted to I should reiterate to everyone that in the case that you are bitten and all that, and seek medical advice. Don't just come to this podcast. I doubt anyone will, but just need to make that known. But definitely it was nice to be here and it was awesome to talk to you and Coyote, and thank you.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate you kind of setting that up. That was very generous of you, and I'm very excited to get this podcast out there so everybody could see. And I really appreciate your medical opinions on these things. Like I know this isn't we're not diagnosing anything here or telling anybody what to do. It is always best, like you said, to go get medical, seek medical attention if you were to, you know, get bit and you're worried about it. I am definitely not a professional of anything. So don't ever take my advice. You know, I just try to share my experience and not tell people what to do. If you get bit, definitely seek medical attention if that needs to be done. Don't listen to what I say. But you definitely have a much more professional insight into these things than I ever will. And it was cool hearing some firsthand experience from Coyote about, you know, what he's gone through as far as envenomation. 'Cause I don't like pain. Like I avoid pain at all costs. So there's no way in the world I would ever subject myself to something like that. But I'm glad people like him are out there that can kind of document that information and show you. 'Cause I am curious about it. And if I were to get bit, now I have a better understanding as to what to expect. And a lot of times knowing what to expect and how to react in a situation is a lot better. You know, it's not going to hurt as bad, and it's not going to be as dangerous, or the consequences, I guess, will be mitigated having that experience and knowledge up front, you know, as opposed to just like not knowing anything, I guess. That's what I'm trying to say, if that makes sense. But at any rate, thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it. If you enjoyed this podcast, you know, make sure that you follow me on, you know, whatever, it could be Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever, and leave a review, because apparently that helps out a lot, kind of getting the word out about the podcast. A huge thanks to you, Doctor. I appreciate you coming on. And like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you know, if you want to go and get some amazing tarantula enclosures, definitely check out tarantulacribs.com and use that code TCollective10 at checkout to get 10% off your order. I'm a huge fan of them, really enjoy them, and they're a huge supporter of the podcast and channel. So I just want to take a moment to thank you personally for that right now.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Appreciate all your support and really enjoy those enclosures. I think it's very cool. But we'll be back next Thursday with a new podcast. So thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.